This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Tenet was personally responsible for rejecting 10 opportunities to capture Osama bin Laden. You know, he just really was not fighting terrorism, but at the same time, he was hyping the idea of Al-Qaeda being such a big threat. So those two things are conflicting, and they point to the idea that Tenet, along with several other of the suspects, were actually promoting a myth about terrorism that they would potentially exploit at some time in the future, and perhaps 9/11 was that opportunity.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Kevin Ryan. Today's show, Another 19, Part 3. Kevin Ryan was site manager for a division of Underwriters Laboratories, or UL. As a manager at Underwriters, he began in 2003 to question the World Trade Center investigation being conducted by UL and the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, and UL's work to ensure the fire resistance of the buildings. Ryan lost his position at UL for making his questions public. He was a founding member of the 9/11 Working Group of Bloomington and Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. He now serves as co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies. He has co-authored several books and peer-reviewed scientific articles on the subject of 9/11. His latest book is Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects. Today we discuss former CIA Director George Tenet, the Secret Service, and the Pentagon. Kevin Ryan, welcome again.
Thank you, Bonnie.
I was most intrigued by your chapter on George Tenet. Where was Director of Central Intelligence George Tenet on the morning of 9/11?
Well, he was in Washington on the morning of 9/11, and he was having breakfast with his mentor, a former senator named David Boren from Oklahoma. And Boren had really sponsored Tenet throughout his career. Tenet became director of the CIA in 1997 and was one of the longest-serving CIA directors in history. And, you know, he was really a suspicious character throughout that time in that he was, Tenet was, hyping the threat of terrorism during that time in the late 80s before September 11th, while simultaneously not actually doing anything about terrorism. So, but one thing that might have caught your eye, Bonnie, is that Senator Boren comes from a very interesting area of the country in Oklahoma City area, where there was a lot of activity related to the alleged hijackers and their alleged accomplice, Zacharias Moussaoui, as well as even going back to the suspects in the Oklahoma City bombing. So David Boren, who helped to create the official account on the news that day, was meeting with Tenet and also has a lot of connections to some suspicious activity at airports in the Oklahoma City area.
Well, I was going to ask you, what is unusual about the Oklahoma City suburb of Norman, Oklahoma? Isn't that where David Boren lives?
Yes, that's exactly. He is the president of the University of Oklahoma, and he lives there. And the university runs its own airport there. And that airport is where this Zacharias Moussaoui character, who, by the way, is the only person convicted of any crimes related to 9/11, currently, Zacharias Moussaoui lived at that university and took flight lessons there at that airport. So Norman is a very interesting a place that hasn't been mentioned a lot. There is also another airport not far from the university airport that's of a lot of interest to me and other researchers, and that is Wiley Post Airport, which is just a few miles away on the west side of Oklahoma City. And the reason is because the actual hijackers, alleged hijackers on 9/11, frequented that area. So they came to these airports. They were seen flying at these airports. And they were also seen at a motel. The motel just outside of Oklahoma City, not far from these airports, was frequented by Mohammed Atta and Marwan El-Shehhi, both the alleged suicide pilots from 9/11. It was also frequented by Zacharias Moussaoui, and these men came to this motel looking for rooms to stay in. The motel owner tried to give this information to the FBI after 9/11, and he met with FBI indifference. They didn't want the information, apparently. What was even more surprising about that is this so-called terrorist motel was frequented also by the Oklahoma City bombers, or the suspects in that bombing. Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols stayed at that motel as well, and the owner of that motel, again, in those early days, tried to get this information to the FBI, and the FBI didn't seem to want it. So that was suspicious. And there's a good article in the LA Weekly about this terrorist motel that lists all of these attempts by the motel owner to get the information out and the FBI not wanting that information. So there's a lot of interesting things and connections between 9/11 and Oklahoma City that really need to be followed up on. I've dug up some of that provides startling evidence that there was something going on at these airports that related to the training or the coordination of the suspected terrorists. And so, for example, Wiley Post Airport was the longtime the location of the offices for the aviation companies run by Wirt Dexter Walker, who was the CEO of the World Trade Center security company Stratesec. So Walker had these aviation companies as well as Stratesec, and the aviation companies were located right there at Wiley Post Airport in Oklahoma City. So that's interesting because the alleged hijackers, Atta and El-Shehhi and a number of others were seen flying at Wiley Post Airport, had come and looked into classes both there and at the University Airport in Norman. But also because after 9/11, Stratesec and the other aviation companies that Walker ran all went bankrupt, coincidentally. And so as Walker moved out of his Wiley Post Airport offices, the person who moved in was a man who ended up being the lead witness in the Zacharias Moussaoui trial. Now, this is just really startling that the reason he was a witness is that he was the trainer for Zacharias Moussaoui at Norman, at the University Airport in Norman. So these connections seem worth following up on, that the World Trade Center security company CEO was running aviation companies out of the same offices that were later occupied by Zacharias Moussaoui's flight trainer. It just seems too coincidental, and that's one of the things that I point out in my book.
And in addition to the airport, what significant role did the University of Oklahoma play? For instance, what about Nick Berg, who was beheaded in Iraq?
Yeah, it's interesting that a University of Oklahoma librarian stated that a ticket for one of the alleged hijackers on Flight 93 was bought by a white American male on one of the university computers. And it's been speculated that the ticket that was purchased at the University of Oklahoma for one of the alleged hijackers was purchased by a man named Nick Berg, who was an American, who was supposedly a student in Norman, and was later the victim of a famous Al-Qaeda kidnapping and beheading. People may remember the video that was showing up on television of Nick Berg being captured and then held, and then eventually his actual beheading was filmed on a video and shown. So it's an alarming coincidence, if nothing else, that Nick Berg, who was a very famous victim of an Al-Qaeda assassination, was also a character who was in contact with Zacharias Moussaoui, an alleged Al-Qaeda operative in Oklahoma City. And Moussaoui supposedly used Nick Berg's email account to send messages. It's very coincidental, and really it needs to be followed up by people with subpoena power. And although this was really startling as well, an implausible sort of story was cooked up for it, that Berg had just happened to meet Moussaoui on a bus and allowed Moussaoui to use his laptop for just 5 minutes on the bus. And that was the excuse how this famous Al-Qaeda victim was somehow connected through the use of his email account by the alleged Al-Qaeda operative, Zacharias Moussaoui.
I remember seeing that video of so-called Al-Qaeda before this famous beheading, and I remember there was a lot of commentary about the so-called Al-Qaeda operatives. They were big, beefy guys, and everyone was commenting that it didn't look like they were starving terrorists.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I felt as well. When you looked at those early propaganda videos, you can't call them anything but that due to the timing, the political convenience of the timing of the videos to kind of promote the ongoing fear of Al-Qaeda. But you could see right away there were some very interesting similarities between what was going on in these videos and what went on in U.S. prisons for Al-Qaeda terrorists. I mean, the terrorists were dressed in the same sort of orange clothing, as if Al-Qaeda was going to use the same procedures as the U.S. prison system. And the Al-Qaeda terrorists looked, as you said, very hefty. If you look at their hands, they look like white people. Their faces were almost entirely covered, so you couldn't tell. But those videos are very suspicious.
Was George Tenet close to Bandar Bush?
Yeah, actually, George Tenet and Louis Free, who was the director of the FBI at the same time, both of them had developed close relationships with Prince Bandar, who was a Saudi prince, and he was the ambassador to the United States at the time. And there are a lot of interesting things about Bandar. He was called Bandar Bush because he was so close to the Bush family, almost a family member. And George Tenet had developed close relationships and private communications processes that circumvented the normal CIA communications processes. So he had his own communications feed to Prince Bandar, and the same sort of thing was true of Louis Free, who was the FBI director at the time. Now, this is very surprising because Bandar's wife, Princess Haifa, was accused, and there is evidence suggesting that she was funneling money to the alleged hijackers in the United States. And so that was not really followed up on, partly because it was part of the evidence presented in a lawsuit made by the 9/11 victims' families that was ultimately thrown out by the court on a technicality. The ability to sue a foreign government was not supported, and of course the Obama administration for some reason was against that lawsuit as well. But Prince Bandar should be followed up. George Tenet has another interesting connection to Louis Free because they both joined the board of a company called Visage, V-I-I-S-A-G-E, Visage Corporation, which is the maker of very high-tech homeland security equipment. They both joined the board of that company in 2006 after they left their roles in government. But that company had been flagged by the Securities and Exchange Commission for 9/11 insider trading. That fact was brought out in some FBI summary documents. And so it seems very revealing that George Tenet and Louis Free, who are the two men most responsible for failing to capture or kill these alleged hijackers, just showed up on the board of a company that was flagged by the SEC for insider trading related to 9/11. There weren't that many companies that were flagged for 9/11 insider trading, just a handful, and one of them was this Visage company. So that needs to be followed up on as well, but it is also another alarming coincidence.
I'm speaking with chemist, research scientist, and author Kevin Ryan. Today's show, Another 19, Part 3. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. What was CIA's new venture, InQtel?
InQtel was a kind of a business incubator that the CIA ran. So it's a pseudo-governmental company, semi-private company. And what they did is they looked for emerging technology. They looked for emerging software companies and other kind of high-tech science companies that somehow would develop into sources of new technology for the CIA. And George Tenet started that company along with some very interesting people, Paul Kaminsky, who was associated with the RAND Corporation and also worked later with a couple of the high-level military people who were missing on 9/11, Hugh Shelton and Mike Canavan. Stephen Friedman, who was a principal with the World Trade Center Impact Zone company, Martian McLennan, was also at InQtel, and he later became George Bush's top economic advisor. He's connected to a lot of the people who are of interest with regard to 9/11 as well. Norman Augustine, who was the CEO of Lockheed Martin, was in on this InQtel operation, and he was a director at Riggs Bank, which is very interesting because that's where Princess Haifa had her account that she was funding the alleged hijackers from. So InQtel is of great interest in many ways, and George Tenet was a primary founder and leader of that company.
What was the worldwide attack matrix that Tenet presented of September 15th, 2001?
Well, Tenet, instead of responding to all of the alarming anomalies that he was associated with regard to 9/11, and I can go through those, but instead of following up on the unanswered questions of 9/11 right away and investigating what happened, instead he came up with this basis for the war on terror called the Worldwide Attack Matrix. It's basically a plan that was followed through as kind of the blueprint for the war on terror that he came up with immediately after 9/11, just immediately, and presented to the White House. So, you know, there's just so many reasons to investigate George Tenet that, you know, his background in creating the blueprint for the war on terror is only one of those. His connections to David Boren, as we mentioned, and Boren's airport where the alleged hijackers trained, and all the other things going on in Oklahoma City. Tenet was responsible for the CIA pretty much allowing two of the alleged hijackers, Al-Medar and Al-Hazmi, to travel to the United States and stay in the United States and do whatever they wanted while they were here without being followed or investigated. You know, his connections to Prince Bandar, as you said, those have to be followed up. His connections to 9/11 insider trading. You know, he had made a decision to disband the Osama bin Laden unit of the CIA in 1998, and he's never had to answer for that. He's been accused by CIA operative Michael Scheuer of canceling or rejecting 10 separate opportunities to capture Osama bin Laden prior to 9/11. That Tenet was personally responsible for rejecting 10 opportunities to capture Osama bin Laden. You know, he just really was not fighting terrorism, but at the same time he was hyping the idea of Al-Qaeda being such a big threat. So those two things are conflicting, and they point to the idea that Tenet, along with several other of the suspects, were actually promoting a myth about terrorism that they would potentially exploit at some time in the future, and perhaps 9/11 was that opportunity.
How did George Tenet handle the 9/11 Commission? And what about the torture testimonies?
Well, Tenet obstructed and tried to prevent any serious investigation into 9/11. He was uncooperative with the joint congressional inquiry. He refused to allow investigators to receive the important cables that would form the basis for the inquiry's report. He wouldn't be interviewed. He denied the request to be interviewed. He just was very obstructionist, and that sort of thing is, it should just not be tolerated. We had just suffered the greatest attack in the history of our country, and the official account was that, these investigative agencies, the CIA and the FBI, were not working together, and they were not doing their jobs sufficiently. And evidence since then shows that they were actually tracking some of these alleged hijackers while they were in the United States and apparently allowing them to proceed with their plans. So for George Tenet to refuse to be interviewed, to not provide the information that is being requested by these congressional investigations, it's just outrageous that he was able to get away with that. One thing that along those lines is Tenet was actually identified by a very early inquiry by the CIA Inspector General. Tenet and a few other characters were named as being essentially accountable, responsible for a lot of the failures. And this CIA Inspector General report suggested there needed to be accountability. There needed to be some response to the fact that these people did not do their jobs. Ultimately, Tenet was let off the hook because the guy who followed Tenet into the job, Porter Goss, who's another suspect in this book, Porter Goss took that and said, well, there's going to be accountability boards. And then he waited another year and he canceled the accountability boards. So Tenet was let off the hook entirely, despite the fact that he worked to prevent a thorough investigation. He did not cooperate with the investigators. The CIA even insisted upon having these people called minders. These minders had to be in place when any witnesses related to the CIA were testifying. So these minders, not only they're like lawyers or intelligence agents who would come along with the witness and they would consult with them as they were being interviewed, but in some cases the minders actually responded to the questions for the witnesses. So the CIA did everything they could to prevent a thorough investigation, and George Tenet was a big part of preventing that investigation from occurring properly.
In your new book, Another 19, you have a chapter on Carl Truscott and the U.S. Secret Service. You write that the U.S. Secret Service failed to do its job on 9/11.
The Secret Service was doing some odd things that day in terms of what they were protecting the president from. And this trip to Sarasota involved a photo op for the president at an elementary school, a community outreach sort of thing. And it had been announced four days before. There had been a great deal of preparation for it. Unusual things begin to happen after it's learned that a terrorist attack is underway. So, the Secret Service was protecting Bush very well up until that point of when he arrived at the elementary school. And this was just a few minutes after 9 o'clock at the exact time that the second plane hit the World Trade Center. At this time, it's been noted that the FAA and NORAD and the military and many other government agencies were aware that three planes had been hijacked. And at that very moment, that two of them had impacted the World Trade Center. And yet, the Secret Service allowed the President of the United States to enter this elementary school, a location that was widely publicized before, and not only enter the school after the second plane had hit, or as the second plane was hitting, but remain in that school for 35 minutes. As I go into in the book, there are certain important questions that need to be resolved with regard to the Secret Service and their behavior that day. So the first thing being that they allowed the president to be there for 35 minutes after they knew that the country was under attack. So as I said in the book, either that's a failure to protect the president, but the alternative explanation was they knew he was not a target, that they allowed him to stay there and didn't do anything to whisk him away and protect him, which is normal policy and procedure for the Secret Service. That's their job, the Secret Service's Presidential Protective Division, which was led by Carl Truscott. Although Carl Truscott was actually in the White House with the vice president, he had a supervisor there who was leading the travel entourage for the Secret Service and the president. That was Edward Marenzel.
Did Bush even give a televised speech while at the school in Florida?
Yes, absolutely, he did. So while he was there for this 35-plus minutes, he gave a televised speech, and he let the world know that he was there, still there at that school, a highly publicized location that he was not being removed from. So that's even more reason to wonder if the Secret Service knew that he was not really a target. And this is fairly well known that President Bush sat in the school reading with children even after he had been told that the country was under attack. At the time, President Bush's White House spokesman, Harry Flesher, was apparently calling the shots for some reason. He was trying to get the attention of the president without the press corps around him seeing it, but he was holding up a sign. A few journalists noticed that Harry Flesher was holding up a sign with big block letters saying, "Don't say anything yet," to the president. As the president was just sitting there, Bush was sitting there doing nothing and being told by his press secretary to not say anything. So all of these things are very odd, but again, that indicates that possibly the Secret Service and the president's detail knew that the president was not a target. That's a big question. I go into the book about a few people that were part of that detail, one of them being Joseph Hagan, who was Bush's deputy White House chief of staff for operations. He had also been an assistant to George H.W. Bush back in the first Bush 1 administration. And he came to the George W. Bush administration from what was called the United Fruit Company, which is a well-known company in terms of being kind of a CIA asset organization.
Yes, isn't that Chiquita Banana?
Yeah, the United Fruit Company, going back to the coup in Guatemala in 1954 and so forth. They've been an organization that's been involved in CIA coups around the world. And so Hagan was a vice president for them, and he came into the Bush administration. He had responsibility for Air Force One and for the White House Communications Agency and for the Secret Service Presidential Protective Division, at least from the White House point of view. And the interesting thing is Hagan is not mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report at all, despite being in such an important role. And the fact that the president was not protected should have led to all of these people being investigated.
I'm speaking with chemist, research scientist, and author Kevin Ryan. Today's show, Another 19, Part 3. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. According to your book, the largest Secret Service field office in the U.S. was in World Trade Center Building 7, which had already been evacuated by the time Bush even reached the school. Hadn't the Secret Service set up a meeting that very morning at WTC 7?
Yeah, this is very interesting that there actually were terrorism-related meetings being organized by the Secret Service in conjunction with Larry Silverstein, who was the owner of Building 7 and the leaseholder for the towers. So the Secret Service and Silverstein had coordinated this terrorism-focused set of meetings in Building 7 on the morning of 9/11. And as I say in the book, there were some interesting military explosive removal groups that had been invited to that meeting and just happened to be there at the time that the buildings were going down. The agency had invited these explosive disposal units from the Army and from the Navy to attend this meeting. You know, Truscott had actually worked in Building 7 when he was assigned to the Secret Service in New York, but he was in Washington at the time. As you said, the building 7 had been evacuated, and Truscott was in the Presidential Emergency Operations Center at that time with Cheney.
Was air cover provided for Bush's motorcade to the airport, or even for Air Force One?
No, the Secret Service did not request air cover for Air Force One or for the motorcade. And the interesting thing is the motorcade appeared to take off in one direction and turn around and come back and go in another direction. And it's kind of reflective of what the president did once he was on Air Force One, flying around the country from Florida to Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana and then up to Nebraska, and finally coming back to Washington later in the day. What's also interesting is that Vice President Cheney, just this year in 2013, has admitted in a documentary airing on Showtime that despite all of the 9/11 Commission's claims that both Bush and the Secret Service were making these decisions as to where the president should go, Cheney says he was actually in charge that day. He says that now, and he was telling the president to stay away from Washington. So those are interesting comments that he's made, and they do make more sense given that one would think the Secret Service would want the president secure, and the country would need the president in Washington while these attacks were going on.
What about the threat against Air Force One? Angel is next, as reported by William Sapphire at the time.
Yeah, this is another reason why it's strange that the Secret Service did not request air cover, because in the 9/11 Commission report as well, it says that there was a threat to Air Force One, and they did track it down to a misunderstanding, apparently. But be that as it may, that gives even more reason to wonder why there was no air cover for the motorcade and for Air Force One if it was known that Air Force One was in fact some kind of target. Even if it was a misunderstanding at the time, they wouldn't possibly have known that at the time. So people must wonder why the president was not protected.
Now, it was later claimed that it was a misunderstanding, but at the time, this so-called threat to Air Force One was confirmed by Ari Fleischer, right? And in William Sapphire's column, I believe it said that that whoever made the threat had the codes for Air Force One.
Yeah, and I've heard all of that, and I report on it a little bit in the book. But I try to emphasize the fact that that is just more reason to wonder why the Secret Service wasn't doing its job. So we can't say for sure if these stories are some sort of excuses for example, why the president was flying around the country randomly, or if they were real threats. And if they were, we have to wonder why there were no appropriate steps taken to protect the president with jet fighter escorts for the motorcade and also for Air Force One.
Now, was there a parallel command system operating on 9/11? And if so, what was it? I mean, to me, this sounds extraordinary. And did Richard Clark verify this?
Yeah. Apparently, the Secret Service had a parallel command system that somehow they were able to track everything that the FAA was tracking. We do know that the Secret Service operated something called Tiger Wall, which was an air surveillance system. And they were aware, we know through the FOIA release documents, that Carl Truscott was aware that aircraft had been identified en route to the Washington area. So he must have known that very early, and yet he didn't take measures to protect the vice president, according to the official account. As I said, this parallel command system, and Richard Clark has mentioned it, that the Secret Service not only had this parallel command system, but they had the authority to authorize the scrambling of interceptor jets, which again goes back to the question of Andrews Air Force Base, when Andrews Air Force Base offered that exact service to the Secret Service when they were talking. And the Secret Service agent said, no, we don't really need that. We'll call you back if we do. Early on, that indicates that something was going on at the Secret Service with regard to knowledge about the planes, and yet the interest in not doing anything about those planes.
Did Cheney himself verify a parallel command system on Meet the Press?
Yes, he almost did. He cut himself off as he was talking about this, so he was indicating that the Secret Service could see what the FAA was seeing. He said on Meet the Press, he said the Secret Service had an arrangement with the FAA. They had open lines after the World Trade Center was, and then he cut himself off. So that, again, indicates that the Secret Service was on top of what was going on, and yet they were either aware of what buildings and people were the targets, or they were not doing their job to protect those people. And in conjunction with the fact that they were running a meeting on terrorism with military explosive ordnance disposal units at World Trade Center Building 7 at the very same time, all of this brings the Secret Service under strong suspicion.
Now, Kevin, with regard to the Pentagon, could you discuss the history of the renovation project at the Pentagon? Now, this is a very important part of this renovation project is a very important part of your chapter on the Pentagon.
That's right, it is. And the reason it is because of the really odd coincidence of where the plane was said to have hit the building. There was a renovation project that had been going on for a number of years before 9/11, and really kind of started in the mid-90s. And this renovation project was under the control of the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Early on, that was John Deutsch. He was a man who later became the director of the CIA. But the reason this Pentagon renovation project, again, is so interesting is that the place where the plane impacted is the exact spot that was the focus of this renovation project. So ultimately, of course, the renovation project was for the entire building, to renovate this entire building, which had been around since 1941 and was in disrepair, apparently. But the focus of the renovation project, particularly from 1997 on, was just exactly in this one wedge where the plane hit. Not only in, there were five wedges to the building, and wedge one is where the plane hit, and that's exactly where the renovation project occurred. But not only that, the renovation project was focused on the external part of wedge one. So we're not only talking about one-fifth of the building, we're talking about maybe one-twentieth of the building. That was the focus of this renovation project from 1997 to the day of September 11th. They were reinforcing the exterior walls, and they were installing blast-resistant windows and backing the exterior walls with Kevlar to minimize shrapnel. The idea, apparently, all along was to prepare this very small part of the building for an attack by explosives. And as you read through the book, you find out that there were classified exercises going on to estimate the damage that would occur to the building from explosives. And it just so turns out that the plane hit that very exact spot. And so I began looking at the renovation. And as I said, the Deputy Secretary of Defense was the person, no matter who it was, who was always in charge of this renovation project, from John Deutsch to ultimately on September 11th, Paul Wolfowitz, who was Deputy Secretary of Defense. And therefore, for the 9 months before 9/11, was in charge of this renovation project. And I think there's a lot of reasons that I'd be happy to go through to take a strong look at what happened there and the companies involved in being contracted for that work and the people at the Pentagon who were in charge of it.
Well, you write that, quote, at the time of the 9/11 attack, a dozen PNAC signatories worked in leadership positions at the Pentagon, including members of the Defense Policy Board. I'm speaking with chemist, research scientist, and author Kevin Ryan. Today's show, Another 19, Part 3. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. How significant is AMEC Construction and Peter Jansen, as well as Fashina Construction?
Well, AMEC, I'll just call it AMEC Construction, was a subsidiary of a British conglomerate, AMEC. And the reason that this company is so important to an independent investigation in a 9/11 was because they were the company hired to do this renovation project. Not only that, but they were the company that was hired to immediately to clean up and reconstruct the Pentagon, and to clean up the World Trade Center site, the same company. The company had played a leading role in controlling the evidence, the steel structural evidence from the 9/11 attacks. It managed the Hudson River barging operation to transport the debris to recycling operations. And so this company that did the construction work under the Pentagon then immediately cleaned up and reconstructed the Pentagon and immediately cleaned up the World Trade Center site and controlled the evidence was led by a man who is a suspect in the book. His name is Peter Jansen. And Peter Jansen was president of AMEC Construction, but just before that role, for 9 years, he was fellow director with Donald Rumsfeld in a company called ABB, Swiss-Swedish engineering company, ABB. So Peter Jansen was a colleague of Donald Rumsfeld for many years throughout the 90s, and then essentially stepped down to this smaller company, AMEC Construction, that had all these key roles in the construction of the Pentagon and the cleanup of the Pentagon and the World Trade Center site.
Now, AMEC Construction received a no-bid contract to clean up the Pentagon site, right?
That's right. And not only that, but they had a significant presence in the oil industry. So here's this company that did a lot of business in Saudi Arabia and did a lot of business for the world's largest or richest company, Saudi Aramco. Suddenly getting no-bid contracts and doing all this work and being led by a colleague of Donald Rumsfeld, and yet they really aren't investigated at all. They didn't have any casualties, even though they had supposedly over 100 people working in the exact spots where the plane hit. Another part of the fatalities this day, that day, of course, there were many people who died, but no high-level leaders of the Pentagon were killed. And yet, these people who were working in accounting offices and, looking into the missing trillions of dollars that Donald Rumsfeld had announced on September 10th, they did die. So AMEC is a very serious suspect in terms of being a company, and the person who led it, being a colleague of Donald Rumsfeld, should be a strong suspect in the crimes.
Now, you've mentioned that there is evidence of explosions at the Pentagon. Have you ever uncovered evidence that a commercial jetliner ever plowed into the Pentagon, as claimed by officialdom?
Well, in the book, I hypothesize something slightly different than is commonly considered within the 9/11 truth movement. Typically, there are arguments as to whether a plane did or did not hit the building. And there are good reasons to believe both of those positions. There's a lack of large debris in the area. There's a strong suspicion of how the plane could possibly have flown so low at such high speed without coming apart or injuring the witnesses who are said to have been there. But there's also reason to believe that that the plane possibly could have been flown through remote-controlled, GPS-guided technology, which did exist at the time. And the types of things that we're talking about have to do with GPS, as I said, and technology called the Wide Area Augmentation System.
Now, a lot of people, of course, feel that the evidence leans toward a missile hitting the Pentagon instead of a plane. Now, I interviewed Hollywood producer Paul Cross not too long ago. He happened to be in Washington, D.C. on the day of and drove over to the Pentagon. He was actually somewhere, I think, across that highway that goes in front of the Pentagon, and he said he got there, and to his astonishment, there was no plane there. And it, of course, changed how he saw the world. So I was just wondering if you've ever come up with any evidence of a commercial jetliner. I mean, there's all sorts of theories about, of course, what hit the Pentagon or what didn't hit it, but was there any real evidence of a commercial jetliner there?
I think the evidence that seems most compelling has to do with pieces of fuselage, and not very large, that are red, white, and blue, the colors of the American Airlines insignia. That there are photographs of such pieces on the lawn. And so there is some evidence that possibly that an American Airlines plane was the victim of the explosives. And there is a lot of evidence indicating explosives at the Pentagon. There were many witnesses saying that there were explosions going on. Some witnesses testified that the aircraft seemed to just melt into the building, or that it sort of disappeared like a toy into a birthday cake, one person said. Another person said it was in the air one moment and it was in the building the next. And so what I hypothesize is that the plane was guided as if it was a missile, using basically missile technology, into the area. At the point it approached the trailers, the construction trailers, which is where the plane was said to have impacted, right in front of the building, then explosives might have been triggered at that time, which would have basically blown the plane into such small parts that it would not have been identifiable. Now, that is all up for discussion, of course. And really, the point I try to make in many cases is that what exact aircraft type might have hit the building doesn't necessarily change who the suspects would be or where the investigation would go. So if you read my book, you see that it would still have had something to do, in my opinion, with the renovation project if explosives were involved, were planted there at the site. It would still have to do with the disabling of the air defenses. It would still have to do with the people who were in charge at the Pentagon and why they didn't suffer any injuries themselves and why they didn't respond to the attack in an effective way. But when we get to the damage to the building and the aircraft, the use of explosives is really the key. The use of explosives can explain the damage done to the building, meaning that in some people's minds, the holes that were created and offered as evidence that a plane actually went through three fortified rings of the building, all of that could be explained through the use of precisely placed explosives. And also a limited amount of recognizable aircraft debris can also be explained through the use of explosives.
But, Kevin, if the official story posits that a commercial jetliner hit the Pentagon, why would they want to blow up the evidence? I don't get that.
Well, okay, so this is the thing. If a plane of that kind was to hit a building like that and had been heavily reinforced, it would not have done a whole lot of damage. That's the problem that they had. So now I can't explain why they did it exactly the way they did it, but I can tell you that you can find videos online of jets hitting a concrete wall and just disintegrating. They don't do much to a concrete wall. This plane, in fact, had a carbon nose. I mean, the Boeing airliners are known to have soft noses and aluminum fuselage, so they're not very strong, other than the engines, which are made of titanium. And so there are pictures of engines in the buildings, and people do discuss what those engine parts indicate and where they came from. And I think there's an argument about that. But in any case, the explosives would give the idea that somehow this big thing came through and it crashed through the building, where, in fact, it's unlikely that a Boeing 757 would have been able to punch through three separate rings of the Pentagon, especially after they had been reinforced.
Well, right. That's impossible. We, of course, talk about hijackers because that is such an integral part of the official narrative. But have you ever discovered hard evidence that any of the planes were actually hijacked?
Well, that's a good question, because the 9/11 Commission, one thing that's important to know is the 9/11 Commission did not tell us how any of the airliners were hijacked. They didn't even really tell us how any of the alleged hijackers, might have entered the cockpits of the planes. And there's so many unanswered questions about how they could have hijacked the planes. You know, if you take the 9/11 Commission report in face value, the alleged hijackers really didn't have a plan. There were procedures for locking the cockpit doors, and apparently the alleged hijackers got by all of that. The hijack codes, which all of the crews were trained to enter into the transponders, took just a matter of seconds, and they were trained to do it immediately under any threat. None of those hijack codes were entered in any of the four planes. The evidence for the alleged hijackers goes back to a couple of weak things. There are a couple of videos, and in my book I mentioned that one of the videos, the strongest one, there really are two only. One's in Portland, Maine, where Muhammad Atta was supposedly taking an inexplicable trip overnight right before the 9/11 attacks, went to Portland, Maine, then came back. There's a video of him in the Portland airport. The only other video of the alleged hijackers entering the airports is from Dulles Airport, where the Flight 77 hijackers were all apparently shown entering Dulles Airport and being screened and so forth. That video system, coincidentally, had been managed by the company Stratese, which is of great interest because it had so many security contracts for the World Trade Center, for Dulles Airport, of course, and for United Airlines. So the evidence showing that the alleged hijackers might have actually hijacked the aircraft is very weak, whereas the technology available and the evidence of what the planes did strongly indicate that those planes might have been taken over by GPS-guided remote control technology that was available at the time.
Kevin Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. There's something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear.
There's a man with a gun over there. I've been speaking with Kevin Ryan. Today's show has been Another 19, Part 3. Kevin Ryan earned a B.S. in chemistry from Indiana University and has worked as a chemistry laboratory manager for many years in Bloomington, Indiana. He is the former site manager for Environmental Health Laboratories in South Bend, Indiana, a division of Underwriters Laboratories, or UL. Kevin Ryan is co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, which publishes peer-reviewed research, and a founding member of Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. He has co-authored several books and peer-reviewed scientific articles on the subject of 9/11. Visit www.journalof911studies.com. That's Journal of the Numbers 911studies.com. Many of his articles can be found at www.ultruth.com. That's ultruth.com. His new book, Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects, can be found at www.another19.com. That's another, the numbers 19.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner and Yara Mako. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at blfaulkner@yahoo.com. That's blfaulkner@yahoo.com. Or Faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Visit our website at www.gunsandbutter.org.
Hey, yo, these are some serious times that we live in, G. And our new world order is about to begin. You know what I'm saying? Now, the question is, are you ready for the real revolution, which is the evolution?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap. We'll be right back.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. Well, it's the dog days of summer. Overcoming my lethargy, I just looked up where the heck the phrase dog days comes from. It took 15 seconds of back-breaking mouse-clicking and key-poking, but it was worth it. Dog days refers to the high position in the sky of Sirius, the so-called dog star, during these hot, humid days. And thus ends our lesson in meteorology, astronomy, and etymology. When I was a kid, most towns had an air-conditioned movie theater within walking distance of the townspeople. That was an excellent place to spend a Saturday dog day afternoon, eating the artery-clogging but delicious popcorn, watching a bad but entertaining movie, and giving our parents a chance to have sex with each other. The last part we didn't know about at the time. To celebrate Dog Days 2011, let's spend the afternoon at the movies, or at least the next 20-some minutes. We'll hear three documentary films about global resource use. They lend themselves well to radio. In all three, the narrator's voice is the key element, and the video is mostly cartoon illustrations. Low-budget films make great radio. We'll end with two short films by Annie Leonard. We'll begin with a short piece called 300 Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Seconds. Let's lean back, pop open a box of oversalted popcorn, and have a listen.
It all started with a big bang. Wait, we don't have to go back that far. The Earth was formed 4.5 billion years ago. No, still too far. Try this. It's the Middle Ages. People in Britain run out of firewood, start burning coal. But they use up the coal on the ground. Miners dig deep. Coal mines fill with water. Samuel Newcomen invents a coal-burning steam engine to pump out water so miners can keep digging. James Watt makes it practical for other uses. Now we have ingredients for the Industrial Revolution, fossil fuels, and a way to put them to work. All hell breaks loose. Coal miners bog down lugging coal. Rails make it easier. Rails and steam engine combined make a railroad. Michael Faraday makes the first electric motor. Nikola Tesla invents alternating current. Soon utility companies start burning coal to generate electricity. Meanwhile, Edwin Drake drills the first rock oil well in Pennsylvania, and Carl Daimler builds an automobile running on petroleum. Coal tar and oil are turned into industrial chemicals and pharmaceuticals that prolong life, more population growth. The Wright brothers start oil-fueled aviation. Fritz Haber and Carl Bosch make fertilizer from fossil fuels. Fertilizer and oil-powered tractors expand food production, feeding more people. World War I is the first fossil-fueled conflict. Then comes World War II, giving us guided missiles and atom bombs. In between is a Great Depression, partly caused by overproduction. Powered assembly lines make products faster than people need them. Advertising executives invent consumerism to soak up overproduction. It's the 1950s. Advertisers use television to hook new generations of consumers. In the 70s, there's an oil shock. Everyone's shocked to realize how dependent they are on oil. With the energy crisis, the environmental movement is born. But oil prices fall, and everyone forgets energy shortages. There's a showdown between market and planned economies. Market wins. Goodbye, evil Soviet Empire. Politicians decide the market will solve everything. Personal computers arrive. Globalization takes over when the market notices labor is cheaper in China. Suddenly, everyone has a cell phone, but world oil production stalls out. China's now burning half the world's coal to make export products. But where will China get more coal and oil to fuel more growth? environmental problems everywhere. Rising CO2 levels lead to record heat waves, floods, droughts. Oceans acidify. Topsoil erodes by 25 billion tons a year from industrial agriculture. Ancient forests disappear. Species go extinct at 1,000 times normal rates. Fresh water is scarce or polluted. Oil companies drill in miles of seawater because the easy oil is gone. But a deep water oil platform explodes and fouls the Gulf of Mexico. Manufacturing moves to polluting countries where labor is cheap, while the U.S. becomes a casino. The financial sector is 40% of the economy. But Wall Street is overleveraged. Banks fail. Unemployment soars. Credit evaporates. The economy is on the verge of collapse. Okay, present time. It's amazing how far we've come in 200 years, just three human lifetimes, from the beginning of industrialism till now. But where are we headed? We can't keep doubling human population. We can't keep dumping carbon in the atmosphere. We can't keep ruining topsoil. We can't keep growing population and consumption or basing our economy on depleting fossil fuels. We can't just print more money to solve the debt crisis. It's been an exhilarating ride, but there are limits. Now, it's not the end of the world, but we have to do four things fast. Learn to live without fossil fuels. Adapt to the end of economic growth as we've known it. Support 7 billion humans and stabilize population at a sustainable level and deal with our legacy of environmental destruction. In short, we have to live within nature's budget of renewable resources at rates of natural replenishment. Can we do it? We have no choice. Alternative energy sources are important, but none can fully replace fossil fuels in the time we have. Also, we've designed and built our infrastructure for transport, electricity, and farming to suit oil, coal, and gas. Changing to different energy sources will require us to redesign cities, manufacturing processes, healthcare, and more. We'll also have to rethink some of our cultural values. None of our global problems can be tackled in isolation, and many cannot be fully solved. We have to prepare for business as unusual. Our best goal is resilience, the ability to absorb shocks and keep going. If we do nothing, we still get to a post-carbon future, but it will be bleak. However, if we plan the transition, we can have a world that supports robust communities of healthy, creative people and ecosystems with millions of other species. One way or the other, we're in for the ride of a lifetime. Understand the issues and pitch in. It's all hands on deck.
Years of Fossil Fuels in 300 Seconds, produced by the Post Carbon Institute, now broadcast on New World Notes. Recognize that musical theme? If I'm not mistaken, that's a riff from the Lou Reed song, Take a Walk on the Wild Side. Speaking of Wild Side, you may recall the films of environmental activist Annie Leonard. New World Notes has broadcast the soundtracks of her films, The Story of Stuff and The Story of Bottled Water. Here are two more that seem to flow smoothly from the Fossil Fuels film. They are The Story of Cap and Trade and The Story of Electronics. Here's Annie Leonard.
I am so glad that the world is finally getting together to stop climate change. When I first heard that our leaders were meeting to talk about solutions, I breathed a huge sigh of relief. Didn't you? Then I said, wait a minute, what exactly are they planning to do about this problem? So I looked into it. And I got to tell you, not all the solutions they're working on are what I'd call solutions. In fact, the leading solution, known as cap and trade or emissions trading, is actually a huge problem. Now, I know this is the last thing you want to hear, but the future of our planet is at stake, so we got to take the time to understand what's going on here. Okay, meet the guys at the heart of this so-called solution. They include the guys from Enron, who designed energy trading, and the Wall Street financiers like Goldman Sachs, who gave us the subprime mortgage crisis. Their job is to develop brand new markets. They stake their claims, and then when everyone and their grandmother wants in, they make off with huge amounts of money as the market becomes a giant bubble and bursts. Well, their latest bubble just burst, and now they have a new idea for a market, trading carbon pollution. They're about to develop a new $3 trillion bubble. But when this one bursts, it won't just take down our stock portfolios. It could take down everything. So how does cap and trade work? Well, pretty much all serious scientists agree that we need to reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere to 350 parts per million if we want to avoid climate disaster. In the U.S., that means reducing our emissions by 80%, maybe even more, by 2050. 80%? Now, the problem is that most of our global economy runs on burning fossil fuels, which releases carbon. The factories that make all our stuff, the ships and trucks that carry it around the world, our cars and buildings and appliances and just about everything. So how are we going to reduce carbon 80% and not go back to living like Little House on the Prairie? Well, these cap-and-trade guys are saying that a new carbon stock market is the best way to get it done. The first step would be getting governments around the world to agree on a yearly limit on carbon emissions. That's the cap. I think that part is great. So how do they want to ensure that carbon emissions stay under the cap? Well, governments would distribute a certain amount of permits to pollute. Every year, there would be fewer and fewer permits as we follow the cap to our goal. Innovative companies will get on board, building clean alternatives and getting more efficient. As permits get scarcer, they would also become more valuable. So naturally, companies who have extra will want to sell them to companies who need them. That's where the trading comes in. The logic is that as long as we stay under the cap, it doesn't matter who pollutes and who innovates. We'll meet our climate deadline, avoiding catastrophe, and oh yeah, these guys take their fee as they broker this multi-trillion dollar carbon racket, market. Save the planet, get rich, what's not to like? Some of my friends who really care about our future support cap and trade. A lot of environmental groups that I respect do too. They know it's not a perfect solution, and they don't love the idea of turning our planet's future over to these guys, but they think it's an important first step and that it's better than nothing. I'm not so sure. And I'm not the only one. A growing movement of scientists, students, farmers, and forward-thinking business people are all saying, wait a minute. In fact, even the economists who invented the cap-and-trade system to deal with simpler problems like fertilizer pollution and sulfur dioxide, they say cap-and-trade will never work for climate change. Here's why I think they're right. When it comes to any kind of financial scam, like subprime mortgages or Bernie Madoff's pyramid scheme, the devil is always in the details, and there are a lot of devils in the details of the cap-and-trade proposals on the table. Devil number one is known as free permits, which is why some people call this system cap-and-giveaway. In this scheme, industrial polluters will get the vast majority of these valuable permits for free. Free! The more they've been polluting, the more they get. It's like we're thanking them for creating this problem in the first place. In Europe, they tried a cap-and-giveaway system. The price of permits bounced around like crazy, energy costs jumped for consumers, and guess what? Carbon emissions actually went up. The only part that did work was that the polluters made billions of dollars in extra profits. MIT economists say the same thing would likely happen here in the U.S. Those billions come from our pockets. A real solution would put that money to work stopping climate change. Instead of just giving permits away to polluters, we could sell them and use the money to build a clean energy economy, or give citizens a dividend to help pay for higher fuel prices while we transition to that clean energy economy, or share it with those most harmed by climate change. Some people call this paying our ecological debt. Since we in the richest countries released the most carbon for centuries and lived a pretty comfy lifestyle in the process, don't we have a responsibility to help those most harmed? It's like we had a big party, didn't invite our neighbors, and then stuck them with the cleanup bill. It's just not cool. Did you know that in the next century, because of the changing climate, whole island nations could end up underwater? And the UN says 9 out of 10 African farmers could lose their ability to grow food. Now, wouldn't a real solution benefit these people instead of just the polluters? Devil number two is called offsetting. Offset permits are created when a company supposedly removes or reduces carbon. They then get a permit which can be sold to a polluter who wants permission to emit more carbon. In theory, one activity offsets the other. The danger with offsets is it's very hard to guarantee that real carbon is being removed to create the permit, yet these permits are worth real money. This creates a very dangerous incentive to create false offsets, to cheat. Now, in some cases, cheating isn't the end of the world. But in this case, it is. And already there's a lot of cheating going on. Like in Indonesia, Sinar Mas Corporation cut down indigenous forests, causing major ecological and cultural destruction. Then they took the wasteland they created and planted palm oil trees. Guess what they can get for it? Yep, offset permits. Carbon out? No. Carbon in? You bet. Companies can even earn offsets for not doing anything at all. Like operators of a polluting factory can claim they were planning to expand 200%, but reduce the plans to expand only 100%. For that meaningless claim, they get offset permits. Permits that they can sell to someone else to make more pollution. That is so stupid. The list of scams go on, and many of the worst ones happen in the so-called third world, where big business does whatever it wants to whomever it wants. And with lax standards and regulations on offsets, they can get permits for just about anything. Devils 1 and 2, cap and giveaway and offsetting, make the system unfair and ineffective. But the last devil, which I call distraction, makes it downright dangerous. You see, there are real solutions out there. But cap and trade with its loopholes and promises of riches have made many people forget all about them. We're not even close to a global agreement on a carbon cap to begin with. And duh, that is the whole point of cap and trade. But instead of hammering out a fair and strong deal, we're putting the cart before the horse and rushing off to trade schemes and offsets. With all the bogus offset projects, huge giveaways to polluters, and the failure to address the injustices of climate change, do you think the third world will get on board with a global cap? I doubt it. If a cap and trade proposal is stopping us from actually capping carbon, it's a dangerous distraction. We don't need to let these guys design the solution. We, us, our governments, we can make laws and do it ourselves. In my country, we already have a law, the Clean Air Act, that confirms that carbon is a pollutant which our environmental agency is allowed to cap. So what are we waiting for? Go, EPA, go! Cap that carbon! Instead, a U.S. cap-and-trade law proposed in 2009 guts the Clean Air Act, leaving it to the market to fix the problem. If a cap-and-trade proposal weakens our ability to make strong laws, it's a distraction. Concerned citizens around the world need to speak out and demand that we redesign our economies away from fossil fuels. But cap and trade makes citizens think everything will be okay if we just drive a little less, change our light bulbs, and let these guys do the rest. If cap and trade creates a false sense of progress, it's a dangerous distraction. These cap and trade proposals are mostly about protecting business as usual. Right now, the U.S. subsidizes fossil fuels at more than twice the rate of renewables. What? We shouldn't be subsidizing fossil fuels at all. These guys don't seem to realize that the simplest way to keep carbon out of the atmosphere is to leave it safely in the ground. U.S. Congressman Rick Boucher, a well-known friend of the coal industry, voted for cap-and-trade. He said it strengthens the case for utilities to continue to use coal. No law that encourages coal use can stop climate change, period. Solid caps, strong laws, citizen action, and carbon fees to pay off ecological debt and create a clean energy economy, that's how we can save our future. The next time someone tells you that cap-and-trade is the best we're going to get, don't believe them. Better yet, talk to them. They probably want a future safe from climate change, too. Maybe they've just forgotten that you can only compromise to a point before a solution isn't really a solution. Look, I know we'd love to sacrifice nothing, save the planet, and get rich doing it. But get real. This is the biggest crisis humanity has ever faced. We can't solve it with the mindset, their mindset, that got us into this mess. We need something new. It won't be easy, but it's time we dream bigger. It's time to design a climate solution that will really work.
The story of electronics.
The other day, I couldn't find my computer charger. My computer is my lifeline to my work, my friends, my music. So I looked everywhere, even in that drawer where this lives. I know you have one too, a tangle of old chargers, the sad remains of electronics past. How do they end up with so many of these things? It's not like I'm always after the latest gadget. My old devices broke or became so obsolete I couldn't use them anymore. And not one of these old chargers fits my computer. Ugh! This isn't just bad luck. It's bad design. I call it design for the dump. Design for the dump sounds crazy, right? But when you're trying to sell lots of stuff, it makes perfect sense. It's a key strategy of the companies that make our electronics. In fact, it's a key part of our whole unsustainable materials economy. Design for the dump means making stuff to be thrown away quickly. Today's electronics are hard to upgrade, easy to break, and impractical to repair. My DVD player broke, and I took it to a shop to get fixed. The repair guy wanted $50 just to look at it. A new one at Target cost $39. In the 1960s, Gordon Moore, the giant brain and semiconductor pioneer, predicted that electronics designers could double processor speed every 18 months. So far, he's been right. This is called Moore's Law. But somehow the bosses of these genius designers got it all twisted up. They seem to think that Moore's Law means every 18 months we have to throw out our old electronics and buy more. Problem is, the 18 months that we use these things are just a blip in their entire life cycle. And that's where these dump designers aren't just causing a pain in our wallets, they're causing a global toxic emergency. You see, electronics start where most stuff starts, in mines and factories. Many of our gadgets are made from 1,000 different materials, shipped from around the world to assembly plants. There, workers turn them into products using loads of toxic chemicals, like PVC, mercury, solvents, and flame retardants. Today, this usually happens in far-off places that are hard to monitor, but it used to happen near my home in Silicon Valley, which, thanks to the electronics industry, is one of the most poisoned communities in the U.S. IBM's own data revealed that its workers making computer chips had 40% more miscarriages and were significantly more likely to die from blood, brain, and kidney cancer. The same thing is starting to happen all around the world. It turns out the high-tech industry isn't as clean as its image. So, after its toxic trip around the globe, it lands in my hands. I love it for a year or so, and then it starts drifting further from its place of honor on my desk or in my pocket. Maybe it spends a little time in my garage before being tossed out. And that brings us to disposal, which we think of as the end of its life. But really, it's just moved on to become part of the mountains of e-waste we make every year. Remember how these devices were packed with toxic chemicals? Well, there's a simple rule of production. Toxics in, toxics out. Computers, cell phones, TVs, all this stuff is just waiting to release all their toxics when we throw them away. Some of them are slowly releasing this stuff even while we're using them. You know those fat old TVs that people are chucking for high-def flat screens? They each have about 5 pounds of lead in them. Lead, as in lead poisoning. So, almost all of this e-waste either goes from my garage to a landfill, or it gets shipped overseas to the garage workshop of some guy in Guiyu, China, whose job it is to recycle it. I've visited a bunch of these so-called recycling operations. Workers without protective gear sit on the ground smashing open electronics to recover the valuable metals inside and chucking or burning the parts that no one will pay them for. So while I'm on to my next gadget, my last gadget is off poisoning families in Guiyu or India or Nigeria. Each year we make 25 million tons of e-waste, which gets dumped, burned, or recycled. And most recycling is anything but green. So are the geniuses who design these electronics actually evil geniuses? I don't think so, because the problems they're creating are well hidden even from them. You see, the companies they work for keep these human and environmental costs out of sight and off their accounting books. It's all about externalizing the true cost of production. Instead of companies paying to make their facilities safe, the workers pay with their health. Instead of them paying to redesign using fewer toxics, villagers pay by losing their clean drinking water. Externalizing costs allow companies to keep designing for the dump. They get the profits and everyone else pays. When we go along with it, it's like we're looking at this toxic mess and saying to companies, "You made it, but we'll deal with it." I've got a better idea. How about you made it, you deal with it? Doesn't that make more sense? Imagine that instead of all this toxic e-waste piling up in our garages or in the streets of Guiyu, we sent it to the garages of the CEOs who made it. You can bet that they'd be on the phone to their designers pretty fast demanding they stop designing for the dump. Making companies deal with their e-waste is called extended producer responsibility, or product take-back. If all these old gadgets were their problem, it would be cheaper for them to just design them longer-lasting, less toxic, and more recyclable in the first place. They could even make them modular so that when one part broke, they could just send us a new piece instead of taking back the whole broken mess. Already, take-back laws are popping up all over Europe and Asia. In the U.S., many cities and states are passing similar laws. These laws need to be protected and strengthened. It's time to get these brainiacs on our side. With take-back laws and citizen action to demand greener products, we can start a race to the top where designers compete to make long-lasting, toxic-free products. So let's have a green Moore's Law. How about the use of toxic chemicals will be cut in half every 18 months? The number of workers poisoned will decline at an even faster rate. We need to give these designers a challenge they can rise to and do what they do best, innovate. Already, some of them are realizing they're too smart to be dump designers and are figuring out how to make computers without PVC or toxic flame retardants. Good job, guys. But we can do even more. When we take our e-waste to recyclers, we can make sure they don't export it to developing countries. And when we do need to buy new gadgets, we can choose greener products. But the truth is, we are never going to just shop our way out of this problem. because the choices available to us at the store are limited by the choices of designers and policymakers outside of the store. That's why we need to join with others to demand stronger laws on toxic chemicals and on banning e-waste exports. There are billions of people out there who want access to the incredible web of information and entertainment that electronics offer. But it's the access they want, not all the toxic garbage. So let's get our brains working on sending that old design for the dump mentality to the dump where it belongs, and instead, building an electronics industry and a global society that's designed to last.
Thanks for joining us for Dog Day Afternoon at the Movies. We heard three short films on related themes: energy and technology, carbon pollution caused by that combination of energy and technology, and tons of other pollution caused by our manufacturing and marketing binge of electronic gizmos designed to fail early. Designed for the dump, as Annie Leonard memorably puts it. How many video players, MP3 players, cell phones, computers, and computer peripherals have you thrown out in the past 10 years? Either because they broke and can't be repaired, or because the cost of repair would be higher than the cost of buying a new one. For me, at least a dozen. How many barrels of oil did it take to manufacture all that short-lived? How many people died of cancer from the toxics used in manufacturing this short-lived junk? How much money, which you don't have you had to spend because if your computer lasts as long as 3 years, you're lucky? Knock on wood, I am producing this installment on an IBM ThinkPad T41 laptop computer that I believe has been in continuous use since 2002. 9 years. No part has failed. The one major problem it had was solved by reformatting its hard disk, which it did on its own, on my instructions. And then it reinstalled the Windows operating system on its own. The manufacturers can do it if they want to. Most of them don't want to, including IBM, which sold off the rights to the ThinkPad to a Chinese company some years ago. I don't want to knock China, by the way. They make long-lived and well-built products when the American marketing companies allow them to. There's the rub. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Ilicitimai non-carborundum, don't recycle, reuse, and hope to see you again next week. Ciao.
Holly came from Miami, FLA, hitchhiked her way across USA, plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, honey, take a walk on the wild side. Candy came from out on the island. In the back room, she was everybody's darling. But she never lost her head, even when she was given. She says, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. Said, hey, babe, take a walk on the wild side. And the colored girls go, do 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 do.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear the speech given by Dr. James Fetzer at the Left Forum in May of 2016. He was part of the panel called the Fabricated Global War on Terror, which was one of six panels addressing the deep state. James Fetzer is a McKnight Professor of Philosophy Emeritus at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. He's the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. He's the editor of Assassination Science and co-editor of Assassination Research. He's also the author of several books, including one on the death of Senator Paul Wellstone. And here he is giving his speech at the Left Forum on the fraudulent global war on terror.
It establishes beyond any doubt that ISIS was made in the USA, sponsored by the American government, created to bring additional pressure upon the Syrian government in order to advance the agenda outlined by Wesley Clark during his speech to the Commonwealth Club on 3 October 2007. I'm taking out the governments of seven countries in the next 5 years, beginning with Iraq and Libya, ending with Syria and Iran.
Here's the actual speech where Wesley Clark states this. And as you can see, the plans for all of the wars we're in were already on the books in September of 2001 and have been maintained and carried out by both Republican and Democratic presidents and their administrations, indicating the deep state is at work here.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the joint staff who had used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, No. He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, "We're going to war with Iraq. Why?" He said, "I don't know." He said, "I guess they don't know what else to do." So I said, "Well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to Al-Qaeda?" He said, No. He says, "There's nothing new that way. They've just made the decision to go to war with Iraq." He said, "I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments." And he said, "I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail." So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, "Are we still going to war with Iraq?" And he said, "Oh, it's worse than that." He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, "This is a memo that describes how we're going to take out seven countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran."
And now back to Jim Fetzer at the Left Forum.
As it happens, Russia has thrown a monkey wrench into that agenda, but not for lack of trying. All of this was a consequence of the orchestrated events of 9/11, which were arranged in large part to transform American foreign policy from one in which, at least officially, we never attacked any nation that had not attacked us first, to one in which we became the greatest aggressor nation in the world, together with our gallant ally in the Middle East, Israel. So to begin the record, which is not intended to be exhaustive, but to provide more than sufficient evidence to establish the key point that ISIS was made in the USA. One of the very first reports we had in the press was from FARS.
Here he's referring to FarsNews.com, an Iranian news outlet. I'd encourage you to check it out. They have a different perspective and cover in much more depth what's happening in Syria than any of our own Western news outlets. And now back to Jim Fetzer.
Describing the Iraqi army having shot down two UK cargo planes. Now, anyone who was paying attention, of course, would have been struck by this. I mean, the Iraqi army has been much maligned, but here it was shooting down two UK cargo planes, which was quite a feat. It made the international press, but not the American. And that was already on 23 February 2015. Within a week or so, we had another development reported again by FARS of the Iraqi Popular Forces shooting down an American helicopter. Now, it seems to me at this point already there ought to have been tremendous concern and apprehension that the situation was completely different than the American government was presenting, because it was becoming increasingly clear that the United States and the UK were deeply involved in supporting ISIS in its efforts. The next development occurred when we learned on 10 April that the United States, Britain, France, and Jordan were refusing to name ISIS as a separate terrorist group. We, of course, had been identifying Al-Qaeda and the Al-Nusra Front as terrorist organizations. They were well known to the United Nations. But this hesitation to identify ISIS as a terrorist group was extremely revealing, that the nations that were declining to do so were almost certainly involved in supporting ISIS itself. Meanwhile, we were getting increasing evidence that many American army personnel were involved in ISIS, particularly because there were so many reports and photographs showing them sporting U.S. Army tattoos. A most unlikely event had this been an indigenous movement of bona fide opponents of the Assad regime, as opposed to something constructed, supported, and aided by the United States, where among the many reports we have been that two retired American generals were directing ISIS. The next slide shows a stunning confirmation coming when Judicial Watch was able to obtain documents from the Defense Intelligence Agency that revealed that the United States itself had created ISIS in order to isolate the Syrian regime. This was published on 19 May 2015 and left no doubt about it. Judicial Watch at the time does not appear to have appreciated the enormity of what it had come across. But we have many reasons to be grateful to Judicial Watch for its ongoing efforts under Freedom of Information Act requests and other legal maneuvers to obtain information about the real actions of the American government, as opposed to the propaganda we received from the administration. The next slide shows that a former U.S. Army lieutenant who had been involved in PSYOPs by the name of Scott Bennett had already discovered that the United States was funding ISIS, not only from the U.S., but from several of the other Gulf states and Israel as well, on June 15th. And as if further confirmation were required, a former CIA contractor by the name of Stephen Kelly reported that the ISIS was part of a never-ending war intended to serve several purposes, breaking apart the countries, disrupting the people, and reducing their ability to stand up to Israel, which is a persistent theme we discover here, that the wars that followed 9/11 had nothing to do with the security threats to the United States, but were a matter of recruiting the United States to perform the dirty work for Israel of taking out the modern Arab states that served as a counterbalance to its influence in the Middle East. Gordon Duff, the senior editor for Veterans Today, reported that the files of an aide to Senator John McCain had been hacked, and we had discovered videos of the faking of the beheading videos on a soundstage in either Tel Aviv or even Hollywood. This was further stunning confirmation that the American people were being subjected to an elaborate charade using Hollywood techniques to deceive the people. It was therefore rather remarkable when Time magazine, which of course is a mainstream publication, reported that ISIS was bringing arms and fighters in from NATO nations. Because Time is such a mainstream journal, this ought to have elicited a reaction from the major media throughout the country. And yet I am unaware of any report from CBS, ABC, NBC, CNN, MSNBC, not even Fox News, to my knowledge, reported this remarkable development, which even Time magazine was confirming. In addition, on July 12, 2015, it was revealed that the Israeli government was exerting a considerable influence over the ISIS terrorist operations. Information about Tel Aviv's support for ISIS in Iraq and the regime's arms aiding the terrorists in Syria, as well as large-scale support from Saudi Arabia and Qatar in the process. The next slide reveals that by the 13th of August 2015, the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, was reporting that ousting Assad would only benefit ISIS in seizing Syria, where, of course, the destruction of the government there was part and parcel of the agenda and therefore was, from the point of view of the United States and its allies, devoutly to be wished. An article that would shortly appear in the New York Times gave a propaganda boost to ISIS as enshrining a theology of rape. This was very elaborate on August 13th, very detailed, and of course did a great deal more to demonize ISIS. Not that it wasn't a legitimate terrorist organization performing a great many atrocities, but further bolstering the official position of the government that we were opposing ISIS when actually we were supporting it. This was not the first time the New York Times was involved in addressing issues related to ISIS, needless to say, because about a year before, on September 11, 2014, it reported how John McCain was having trouble shaking off reports that he was involved in the creation of ISIS, about which, in my judgment, there is no serious doubt. ISIS is known in Washington, D.C. as John McCain's army, where he appears to have exerted considerable influence on the administration to bring about the creation of ISIS. For further confirmation that the United States was supporting ISIS, not opposing it, the next slide shows that Alexei Pushkov, the head of the Russian Parliament's International Affairs Committee, reported that the United States wasn't bombing ISIS, but actually was taking the occasion of using alleged attacks on ISIS to take out the superstructure of Syria, bombing bridges, roads, grain silos, and the like in order to weaken the government of Syria, and that the United States was simply lying to the American people, indeed, to the entire population of the world. By 19 October 2015, Vladimir Putin was revealing information that ISIS was being assisted by the American government. Russian General Staff Andrei Kardapov explained that photos of the area with bomb-destroyed buildings, there were no ISIS fighters. So they were doing bombing runs on non-ISIS targets and presenting them as though they had something to do with ISIS. Of course, by now we're all well familiar, as the next slide shows, that ISIS claimed responsibility for Paris, as many students have revealed. This appears to have been another propagandistic attack, like Charlie Hebdo, that was directed at France because the French people were too enthusiastic in their support for the creation of a Palestinian state in the wake of the attacks in Paris and Charlie Hebdo, of course, rather draconian laws have been passed there, including very severe restrictions on any expression of criticism of Israel, which is very telling as to what was going on. Here's a fascinating report now from 19 November that the Syrian oil tanker drivers are warned before U.S. bombs are dropped on convoys transporting oil from Syria, principally to Erdogan in Turkey, which then is much of it given back to Israel or sold, making vast sums of money for Erdogan and his son. But this appears to be a reflection of the consciousness of guilt of Barack Obama, being aware that he was responsible for the creation of ISIS. He has leaflets dropped to warn the drivers they're going to be attacked. Then strafing runs are conducted to let them know this is serious, so they can get out of their trucks and not be harmed before any bombing takes place. As the next report reflects from 16 November 2015, Vladimir Putin has, right, ISIS is being financed by some 40 countries, including many of the G20. I mean, this is a complete outrage. And it's only Russia Today that's reporting the truth about what's actually taking place here. So it's remarkable that when I was a young man, I was told that the Russian press was completely unreliable and untrustworthy. But it turns out you can learn more truth from Pravda than you can from the New York Times, more from Russia Today than you can from the Washington Post regarding these affairs. President Assad himself has explained that France, the UK, the US, and Saudi Arabia are all involved in supporting ISIS. There's no question but what his reports are accurate. Here's some quotes. When those countries that I mentioned, France, UK, US, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and some others, stop supporting the terrorists, things will improve. If you want to fight and defeat them, you have to cut and suffocate their supplies or armaments, money, coming mainly through Turkey and with the support of the Saudis and the Qataris. I think that the downing of the warplane, this is in the aftermath of the shooting down of a Russian jet, has shown the real intention of Erdogan, who, let us say, lost his nerve because the Russian intervention has changed the balance on the ground. Now, the next slide reveals something terribly, terribly important that the world needs to understand. All of these developments related to the creation of ISIS took place during the presidency of Barack Obama, who, of course, was elected in 2008 and will only step down next year, where Hillary Clinton became the Secretary of State in 2009 and served until 2013. Hillary not only supported the war in Iraq, she motivated the attacks on Libya, where Muammar Gaddafi was a benevolent dictator who was sharing the wealth of Libya with the Libyan people, national health care, national public education, taking on the great waterworks project that would have turned North Africa into a veritable oasis, and where he was also introducing the gold dinar. She has now been revealed to have been deeply involved in Libya. Emails that are being revealed that show the true motives have nothing to do with the alleged abuse of Gaddafi of the Libyan people, where there was virtually no crime. Any medical problem that couldn't be dealt with in Libya, the government would fly the person with a friend or relative anywhere in the world, all expense paid by the Libyan government, national warehouses where anyone who needed food could go. This was, if not an idyllic society, certainly it was a close proximity where Gaddafi was expected to receive a humanitarian award from the United Nations just 3 weeks before the invasion, which was quite catastrophic. I've interviewed Jimmy and Joanne Moriarty, who were there at the time. They had developed an organic process for disposing of organic waste that was completely non-polluting and environmentally friendly, and they witnessed what was going on involved, say, being paid three times for the same body, first to kill them, then to chop them up, then to burn them, where rape became an all-pervasive instrument of war. And today, of course, as we well know, Libya is in chaos and a breeding ground for terrorism. Hillary has not only desirous of increasing the war in Syria, she's talked about bombing Iran at Dartmouth last year. She said when she became president, she'd be in the position to bomb Iran to annihilation. It's rather stunning that the Secretary of State seems not to know the history of the Iranian nuclear program, where all 16 U.S. intelligence agencies concluded already in 2007 that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, a conclusion they reaffirmed in 2011, where even the Mossad concluded that Iran was not pursuing nuclear weapons, which they reported to the Israeli government 3 weeks before Benjamin Netanyahu went to the United Nations and asserted precisely the opposite. In addition, our sanctions on Iran were violations of Article 33 of the Geneva Conventions of 1949 that preclude the punishment of any individual for a crime they did not personally commit, so that we have been committing war crimes in Iran by virtue of our forms of collective punishment. I wrote to 97 members of the United States Senate with precisely the information I've just outlined here, and I received a response from one about an irrelevant subject. So it's very clear the American Senate is either unaware or completely culpable in these ongoing war crimes and offenses in the Middle East, including Iran. Moreover, Hillary is clearly a neocon and one of many members of the Obama government, including Victoria Nuland at the Department of State, Samantha Power at the United Nations, Ash Carter at Defense, Susan Rice as Obama's National Security Advisor, who are all committed to the neocon agenda. It's shocking that the American people are so unaware that Barack Obama himself is a neocon aggressively pursuing these wars in the Middle East, where the Nobel Committee made a colossal blunder in awarding him a Peace Prize. History will reflect he was the most undeserving recipient in history. New revelations from the emails have confirmed what I am reporting to you now, as the next slide reveals. This is from Hillary's actual email account that were being sent over unclassified servers, where the Inspector General for the Department of State has observed major violations of security protocol, where Hillary was instructed before she became secretary that classification is not a question of whether one of these documents is or is not stamped classified, secret, or top secret, but a function of the content. We even have a report now that in at least one instance, she instructed a correspondent to snowpack out the word secret before it was transmitted to her, so she could maintain the false claim that she had never received or transmitted over her server any documents that were actually labeled classified. And where it turns out that a Romanian hacker was able to break into the account, he has reported that there were at least 10 others who were viewing the contents of her email server at the time. The Russians discovered this because he tried to hack into a Russia Today account, and the Russians now have been deliberating over whether or not to release 20,000 emails they have in their possession from Hillary Clinton's account. Here's a sample that I find particularly revealing. The best way to help Israel deal with Iran's growing nuclear capability is to help the people of Syria overthrow the regime of Bashar Assad. Back to Syria. It is a strategic relationship between Iran and the regime of Bashar Assad in Syria that makes it possible for Iran to undermine Israel's security, not through a direct attack, which in the 30 years of hostility between Iran and Israel has never occurred, but through its proxies in Lebanon, like Hezbollah, that are sustained, armed, and trained by Iran via Syria. The end of the Assad regime would end this dangerous alliance. Israel's leadership understands why defeating Assad is now in its interest. There's no question but what Hillary's emails confirm what I've been reporting here, to wit, that our involvement in the Middle East has been to promote the interests of Israel, not that of the United Nations, which takes us back to Wesley Clark's report at the Commonwealth Club in California, which may be the most honorable act of his career. The fact that ISIS is capable of defeat, because we have learned that between February 1st and February 4th, the Russians conducted 900 hits on ISIS, 900 hits on ISIS in 3 days. And yet we have the complete absurdity of John Kerry issuing an ultimatum that was just published on the 3rd of May of 2016, that Assad must leave or suffer the consequences. Well, what possible consequences can he be talking about? I mean, this is bizarre in the extreme. When the United States is actually on the wrong side of the case, when the Russians are in the right, we've had nothing from the government but demonization of Russia. It would have been most appropriate to reach out to the Russians to join in the effort to defeat ISIS, were it not the case that ISIS is our own instrument of influence in the Middle East, where we continue to act not in the interests of the United States, but on behalf of Israel as its veritable agent, where Cynthia McKinney has revealed that when new members of Congress come to Washington, they're asked to sign a pledge to put the interests of Israel ahead of those of the United States, which is shocking in and of itself. Those who do not sign find themselves confronted with a well-financed alternative candidate during the next election, or may even discover that their district has been redrawn and they no longer have a seat. As my final slide, let me mention and praise Wayne Madsen, whom I regard as our nation's leading investigative journalist. Wayne has exposed one form of corruption after another, and I regard his Wayne Madsen reports as an invaluable source of information about what's really going on in the United States within the administration from sources, many of which are reluctant to come forward publicly, but where Wayne is able to reveal, in this instance, the shocking truth behind the Army of Terror in his new book, ISIS is Us. So my shout out to Wayne Madsen, whom I admire beyond words, and my grateful appreciation to all of you for affording me this opportunity to explain how we know that ISIS was made in the USA.
And again, you were just listening to Professor James Fetzer speaking at the Left Forum on the fabricated global war on terror. To see the full video, you can go to YouTube and search for James Fetzer and the Left Forum. Many people are pointing to the fact and the evidence that ISIS is a fabrication and is a creation of the CIA and its allies. Professor Michelle Chusadovsky of globalresearch.ca states in a September 2014 article called "The Terrorists Are Us, The Islamic State Big Lie," that, quote, "Under the auspices of the United Nations Security Council, with President Obama chairing the council session, the United States has called upon the international community to adopt strong measures at national and international levels to curtail the recruitment of Islamic State fighters. What is not mentioned in the media reports is that the heads of state and heads of government who have endorsed America's campaign against the Islamic State, advised by their respective secret services, are fully aware that U.S. intelligence is the unspoken architect of the Islamic State, which is part of a vast network of U.S.-supported jihadist terrorist entities. Countries are either coerced into supporting the U.S.-sponsored resolution or they are complicit in the U.S. terror agenda. Lest we forget, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, have been financing and training the ISIL terrorists on behalf of the United States. Israel is harboring the Islamic State on the Golan Heights, NATO, in liaison with the Turkish High Command, has since March 2011 been involved in coordinating the recruitment of the jihadist fighters dispatched to Syria. Moreover, the ISIL brigades in both Syria and Iraq are integrated by Western special forces and military advisors. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Due to its broadcasting without critical comment of the Reverend William Barber's endorsement of Hillary Clinton at the DNC, in which he praises Clinton in the highest possible moral terms, we will not be bringing you Building Bridges this week, as we consider the uncritical broadcasting of this content inappropriate. Instead, we bring you Ground Wire.
I'm not leaving until we get 100% socialized.
Liters of jet fuel was discharged into Lemon Creek and entered the Slocan River and the Kootenai River, killing fish and harming aquatic ecology. That was on July 26, 2013.
I can't stop thinking about how violent Abdi's life and the lives of many marginalized people was on a daily basis.
Welcome to Groundwire, community radio news.
This episode of Groundwire was produced by volunteers at Kootenai Cooperative Radio on Sinaixt Traditional Territory in Nelson, B.C.
In this episode,
Groundwire speaks with one of the organizers of the recently occupied Garden City Camp at 58 Hastings Street in Vancouver.
And community members in Montreal demonstrate against police brutality after Abdirahman Abdi dies following injuries sustained during an arrest in Ottawa.
But first, here are the headlines.
3 years after a tanker truck spilled 33,000 liters of jet fuel into Lemon Creek in the Slocan Valley, federal prosecutors have laid 8 charges against the trucking company Executive Flight Center, as well as its driver and the BC government. The fuel spill into Lemon Creek polluted the Slocan River, resulting in an evacuation and orders not to drink the water for several days. Slocan Valley resident Marilyn Burgoon initially filed charges in a private prosecution, and then in January of this year, the government decided to take over the prosecution, filing for 2 counts of depositing a deleterious substance in water frequented by fish under the Fisheries Act and 6 counts of introducing waste into a stream causing pollution under the Environmental Management Act. Bruce Edson from Kootenai Co-op Radio spoke with Marilyn Burgoon about the spill.
33,000 liters of jet fuel was discharged into Lemon Creek and entered the Slocan River and the Kootenai River, killing fish and harming aquatic ecology. That was on July 26, 2013, when I fully expected that charges would be laid. For years, they weren't laid, so I took it upon myself to do the rare thing of filing a private prosecution. And at the time I filed it, that I had to go through a preliminary hearing with a judge to prove that it wasn't a frivolous case, that I did have the facts that under the Fisheries Act, deleterious material had been put into the creek. So from that point on, we had expected the public prosecutor to take over, since that is their job. It's a public interest. Thousands of people were evacuated from their homes, so it was quite a very public interest case. West Coast Environmental Law, who's been supporting me in this case, had on their website thousands of letters sent to the Minister of Justice to get the federal prosecutor to take over. And this happened in January here. The public prosecutor decided to take over and intervene in the case.
The court case is set for September 13th.
Up next,
CKUT's Geneva Gleason brings us an update on the Lakatos family, who are facing deportation.
On July 16th, the temporary residence permit for 2 Hungarian Roma women of the Lakatos family expired, leaving the women to face deportation. They were summoned to a meeting at the Canadian Border Services Agency, the CBSA, on Thursday, July 28th, during which the CBSA refused their application for permanent residence on humanitarian grounds. Activist group Solidarity Across Borders organized a support rally while the Lakatos women awaited the decision. Community members from several countries of origin gathered in front of the agency to show their support. The Lakatos family have lived in Canada since June 2011 and have faced deportation since their refugee demand was denied in April 2015. In March 2016, the father and brother of the family were deported to Hungary, where they continued to face the racial discrimination and persecution that forced the family to flee Hungary in 2011. After the women exited the meeting, Gilda Lakatos, who is 17 years old, told the press that she is exhausted and that after 5 years she is still not able to lead a normal life due to the government's treatment of her family. Solidarity Across Borders suggests that community members who want to get involved call or email the MP in their riding and ask them to contact Minister of Immigration John McCallum in support of the Lakatos family. For more information, visit solidarityacrossborders.org or RomanIpe, RomanIpe.wordpress.com.
July 18th was World Listening Day, an annual global event that celebrates the ecology of the world's acoustic environments. Check out the webpage of the World Listening Projects at worldlisteningproject.org to hear thousands of sound design projects uploaded from all over the world. This piece was recorded in Egypt by Bassam Yakut of the Oystat Sound Design Group, an international body of sound designers and sound artists who primarily work in theater and the performing arts.
That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this.
Now it's time for our feature stories.
About 150 people have pitched tents in an empty lot at 58 Hastings Street in Vancouver. Gunarji O'Sullivan spoke with Simona, one of the camp organizers, who plans to stay until the city commits to building on that site social housing at pension and welfare rates.
What we're looking for is for this to be 100% self-contained units. That doesn't mean like PHS that you have to phone home every 3 days. You know, it's where you have your own key, your own door, your own friends can come over and visit. I think the harshest thing is welfare day, which most of us get our most money then, they're saying, oh, you can't have any friends in there. So they're either saying, you have to go outside and risk being jumped, mm-hmm. robbed, yeah. arrested.
Yeah.
You know, anything can happen. Or sit in your room by yourself and get high, which who supports? Not yeah. us, you know.
Yeah. Vancouver, and especially the downtown east side, lacks adequate affordable housing and has a huge problem with homelessness. Mayor Gregor Robertson campaigned on a promise to eliminate street homelessness by 2015, but the 2016 stats for homelessness are the worst in a decade. Garden City started on July 9th when more than 200 people attended a day of action for housing justice called by the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users and the International League of People Struggle. On that day, a number of people pitched tents in a vacant lot at 58 West Hastings Street. The number of residents living in Garden City has now grown to about 150 people in 74 tents.
What we did is we looked at all the different tent cities we had, like the Oppenheimer, the Olympics, the Woodward, you know, mm-hmm. Victoria. That's why all of our tents are 3 feet apart. Because we know that the firemen will make it or break it. You know, keep them happy and jump through their hoops and we're here, right? Because I'm not leaving until we get 100% social housing.
Good.
Self-contained units. You know, like, When you get supportive housing, it's awesome for some people. You know, some people need that. But other people don't. And I feel like I'm 9 all over again when I go out and they're like, phone home every 3 days. For real? Like, 3 days? Whoa. That's a blink of an eye sometimes, you know, especially down here, like...
This isn't the first time the property has hosted a tent city. In 2010, during the Winter Olympics, which were held in Vancouver, 58 West Hastings was the site of the Olympic Tent Village. In 2015, the City of Vancouver designated 58 West Hastings as the future home of one of the Vancouver Affordable Housing Agency's 7 sites of affordable housing. However, the current plans indicate that only 15% of any units built will rent at income assistance rates, while 31% will be affordable market rates and 58% will be subsidized rents. So there is sure to be further displacement of low-income people in the neighborhood and a further loss of affordable housing. Simona and other Garden City organizers are meeting with Mayor Robertson this week to discuss the property. When Ganarji asked if the Garden City residents needed anything, Simona said,
"We need donations."
Yeah. And where are you located?
58 West Hastings.
Do you have e-transfer?
We have a GoFundMe account.
Uh-huh.
And it's VancouverTentCity.wordpress.com.
Okay. Thank you so much joining us today, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thanks to Ganarji O'Sullivan from CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio, for that interview. On July 24th, Abdurrahman Abdi was beaten by Ottawa police and later died of his injuries. Jessica Zarek from CKUT Radio reports on a community demonstration that took place in Montreal later that week.
On July 28th, community members in Montreal took part in a demonstration to denounce police violence and a vigil to honor the life of Abdurrahman Abdi, a 37-year-old black Somali man who died after sustaining injuries at the hands of police during an arrest in Ottawa. This demonstration was co-organized by members of Montréal Noir and Justice for the Victims of Police Killings Coalition. Idil spoke at the demonstration.
We flee violence only to be met with a different kind of violence. Abdurrahman came to Canada for the promise of safety and to work towards a better life. The fact that Abdi did not die amidst the violence and insecurity of Somalia, but in the supposed safety and refuge of Canada, is a tragic irony. One of the most heartbreaking aspects of Abdi's story has to do with his mental illness. His family have said that he was dealing with an unspecified mental illness, and those in the community also knew that he was afflicted with an illness. The fact that it was unspecified does not surprise me. Many people in our community deal with mental illness but do not have the access to resources to be able to get the necessary help. There is an understanding, often unspoken, of the trauma that exists in our community. Those back home and those in the diaspora are dealing with unimaginable trauma and pain from decades of war, displacement, loss, and poverty. Did the police officers recognize this trauma? Did they see his mental illness? Or did they see a monster, a deviant, a thug? I have no interest in discussing what may have led to the call that brought police to Hindenburg on Sunday, because whatever Abdi did not deserve that kind of malicious, hateful, violent response. In that moment, Abdurrahman was not afforded his humanity, the same humanity that would likely be afforded to his white counterpart. He was seen as an expendable deviant. I think it's important that we also expand our understanding of violence. While killings of this nature are examples of violence in its most extreme form, I can't stop thinking about how violent Abdi's life and the lives of many marginalized people was on a daily basis. His exclusion from the comforts of society, how he suffered emotionally and mentally. Abdurrahman's story highlights how we love to boast about how we are a country of immigrants, but how we are not too concerned about the welfare and quality of life of immigrants.
Marion Lopez spoke personally as a mother of a black autistic boy.
Before I share, I want to denounce the way the media is using Abdurrahman's Abdi's unspecified mental health as a strategy to avoid talking about how race played a role in his death. They can't justify police violence by blaming it on disability or mental illness. And we can't allow the media or the police to use one type of discrimination to excuse another. By focusing on Abdi's mental capacity, we are concealing structural racism under the cloak of ableism. We cannot forget the obvious. It is not reasonable to beat an unarmed man to death. So I ask you folks out here this evening, what do Andrew Loku, Abdurrahman Abdi, Freddie Gray, Tanisha Anderson all have in common? Most of you will say that they were all black and that they were all victims of police violence. But there is one more thing that they have in common. They all suffered from mental health issues or disabilities. Racial profiling continues to be a persistent issue in policing. So what happens when someone is both black and disabled? People with disabilities or with mental health issues may struggle to comply with police orders, panic, and appear to be resisting, which increases chances that police will rely on the excessive use of force. Finally, I want to finish just by saying that we need to open spaces for disabled, neurodivergent people of color to tell their experiences from their perspectives. This is something I will fight for the rest of my life because it's personal. I have a 7-year-old beautiful black boy who is on the autism spectrum. Racial bias and ableism increase chances that he will be confronted with police in the future. This haunts me all the time, and it's the reality I deal with every day as a mother. I imagine all the things that can go wrong in a world that fears my son's skin color and doesn't understand the way his brain works. So please, folks, let's stay woke.
Now it's time for our community radio report. The recent dismissal of Commissioner Raj Shon from the CRTC suggests a larger issue of systemic racism within the CRTC and also across the media landscape in Canada. Ome Samarahemtula of Groundwire interviewed two representatives from the Community Media Advocacy Centre about the dismissal and what they see as some of its larger implications.
Last month, at the recommendation of the Minister of Canadian Heritage, Melanie Joly, the Governor General and Council terminated Raj Shon's position as CRTC Commissioner for Ontario. The Canadian Radio Television and Telecommunications Commissions, the CRTC, appoints commissioners to represent each region in Canada for a term of 5 years. Commissioner Shon was only in his third year at the CRTC when he was dismissed. Christiana Clemens is the president of the Community Media Advocacy Centre and has spent 2 decades working in community radio, most recently as the station manager of CFRC Community Radio in Kingston, Ontario.
That's to say that in almost 50 years that we've had the Canadian Radio, Television and Telecommunications Commission, Only two of 103 individuals that have been appointed are identified as visible minorities. Now, that's the terminology used by the government to identify people of color, but according to Statistics Canada, over 19% of our population belong to visible minorities, and that's anticipated to go up to 23% by next year. So clearly, there's an enormous deficit and lack of representation of people of color on the commission historically. And to the present day, the commission can have up to 13 commissioners on it, and Raj was the only quote unquote visible minority on the commission out of eight commissioners that were serving.
The reasons for Commissioner Schoen's dismissal have not been publicly disclosed, but it is widely believed that they are related to the ongoing legal action between Schoen and CRTC Chairman Jean-Pierre Blaise. In April 2015, Schoen applied for a judicial review of Chairman Blaise's decision to accept the results of a report that concluded Schoen's behavior toward a CRTC employee constituted harassment. Schoen's subsequent dismissal came only days after the first public hearing in this judicial review, at which Presiding Justice Russell Zinn commented, "It was troubling that Chairman Blaise was both a witness in the harassment investigation and the vigil who accepted the report's findings." But most troubling to this case are documents filed in Schoen's legal challenge to his dismissal that allege a toxic environment of overt racism within the CRTC, enforced through a culture of fear and intimidation. Schoen argues that a racist double standard was used in handling harassment allegations against him, as compared to a white commissioner who he alleges referred to him as a spoiled rich brown kid who probably grew up with servants, requested to change hotels on commission-sanctioned travel because there were too many black people, and complained that it smelled like curry in her office after meeting with ethnic broadcasters. The CRTC is a public authority that regulates broadcasting and telecommunications on behalf of all Canadians, including those impacted by systemic and overt racism. The dismissal of Commissioner Schoen points to a context lacking equitable representation of people of color on the commission and a historic ongoing lack of equitable access for and representation of racialized communities within Canada's media and telecommunications landscapes. Laith Marouf is a consultant at the Canadian Media Advocacy Centre and a longtime multimedia producer who is currently serving as the coordinator of Independent Community Television Montreal.
Representation and equity in media in general in Canada is very lacking. If you take a quick look, obviously, on the private and the public broadcasters, there is very little productions that are specifically dealing with issues of communities that are seeking equity and representation, be it visible minorities, linguistic minorities, and indigenous nations. On the other hand, where it's expected that these communities receive equity, or it's more expected, I guess, is in the community media sector. And unfortunately, there also there is huge failures in giving representation and equity. So, well, on the ground, the community radio stations and community TV stations are mainly staffed, again, with white staffings, and their boards are also mainly white. So where does communities seeking equity find it in the Canadian media spectrum? Broadcasting is hard to pinpoint any place.
Even though Commissioner Schoen comes from a corporate media background, many believe he was a strong ally and that his dismissal is a great loss for community media.
So I worked in campus and community radio off and on for about two decades at stations across Canada, most recently at CFRC-FM in Kingston. And in March, Raj Schoen paid CFRC Radio a visit. He got a tour and he sat with myself and other staff and gave an open ear to the concerns that we had with regard to the commission, learned about our history and our volunteer base and our programming, and seemed quite actively interested and commented that he was visiting many stations in communities across southern Ontario, in the community sector, as well as commercial broadcasters, and paying them visits and just sort of getting a sense of what was happening in the region that he was representing on the commission. And in more than two decades of working with community radio, this is the first time that a commissioner has ever come to pay an individualized visit to a station that I was working at. I know often, even with national gatherings in the community radio sector, it's often difficult to have a representative from the commission, among the commissioners, to actually attend that national gathering. So let alone someone who's conscientious enough about the sector and wanting to listen to what people in the sector have to say enough to go pay an individual station or many of our stations a visit, as Joanne did across southern Ontario.
The CRTC has already started a search to replace Commissioner Schoen in Ontario, in spite of the fact that the court proceedings related to Schoen's harassment and dismissal cases are not yet concluded, and no public reason was given for his dismissal.
Village pier beneath a big crane standing, and all the love I felt for her, it passed all understanding. Took her sailing on the river flow, sweet river flow. London town was mine to give her, sweet Thames flow softly. Made the Thames into a crown, flow, sweet river, flow. Made a brooch of silver town, sweet Thames, flow softly.
Here at Groundwire, we want to remind you to check out World Listening Day coverage at theworldlisteningproject.org. You can hear thousands of sound design projects uploaded from all over the world. This is a piece called Tetu 2, which was recorded in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. That's it for this edition of Groundware, produced by volunteers at Kootenai Cooperative Radio on Sinek's traditional territory in Nelson, BC. Music this week was by James Keelahan, Quator Bozzini, and the World Listening Project.
Headlines this week were written by Geneva Gleason, Carly Forbes, and Catherine Fisher, with files from Bruce Edson.
We also thank Gunnar G. O'Sullivan, Ome Salmara Hemtula, Jessica Zarek, and Carly Forbes.
I'm Yvette Jansen.
And I'm Catherine Fisher.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station, download at groundwirenews.ca, or podcast at rabble.ca.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
We're at the Hollywood Museum with the opening of reel-to-reel depictions of gays and lesbians in Hollywood.
One of our earliest allies, Burt Lancaster, emceed our first major fundraiser.
It's very important, isn't it, for the LGBT community to be celebrated?
Rise up and fight for our rights and power.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Religious right pushes gay sex ban in Indonesia's top court, Hollywood peeks at its queerest perceptions, and a lion-hearted lesbian lays bare Kenyan injustice. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Jason Proctor.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending August 6, 2016. Indonesia's highest court is considering a case filed by a coalition of far-right Islamic activists demanding that private consensual adult gay sex be outlawed in the predominantly Muslim nation. They're asking that such acts be punished by up to 15 years in prison. Current Indonesian law does not specifically criminalize same-gender sex, although it can be brutally punished under Sharia, or Islamic law, which governs Aceh province. A group calling itself the Family Love Alliance calls for sex between adults of the same gender and the rest of ostensibly secular Indonesia to be prosecuted under statutes that outlaw an adult engaging in sex with a minor. The 9-judge Constitutional Court formally accepted the Jakarta-based Islamic group's judicial review petition this week. Rita Hendrawati, chairwoman of the Family Love Alliance, denied that her group was attempting to criminalize those who have a deviant sexual orientation, but told the Jakarta Post that the LGBT community is spreading propaganda to make it seem as if casual sex or same-sex relationships are okay. The group presented experts at the court on August 2nd, testifying that homosexuality is inherently immoral and that it contravenes Indonesia's state ideology. Testimony from those opposed to criminalizing same-gender sex will be heard later this month.
The legal attack seems to build on the escalating denigration of Indonesia's sexual minorities by Islamic clerics and government officials. Even the country's leading psychiatric body classified being LGBT as a curable mental disorder earlier this year. The defense minister declared the LGBT rights movement to be more dangerous than nuclear warfare, and the Indonesian Broadcasting Commission has banned what it calls gay propaganda and effeminate males on television. The Family Love Alliance's petition also affects heterosexuals. It wants the High Court to expand adultery laws to apply to unmarried couples.
Law enforcement harassment and threats of violence by a government cabinet minister forced Ugandan LGBT rights activists to cancel a pride celebration in a private space in the outskirts of the capital city of Kampala planned for August 6th. Falsely charging that a gay wedding was taking place, police raided the Mr. and Miss Pride pageant at Kampala's Venom nightclub on August 4th, detaining and harassing about 200 attendees and arresting some 24 people, including well-known Ugandan activists Frank Mugisha and Pepe Julian Onziema. Some reports suggested that police officers particularly targeted and sexually abused several trans women and that one man was seriously injured after jumping through a 4-story window trying to escape the raid. The organizers were also accused of holding the event without a permit, which they vehemently denied. Onziema told BuzzFeed News that there's no way we would hold an event without a clearance. They don't care as long as the word homosexuality is not mentioned, he said. As soon as that is mentioned, everything else ceases and police feel they have to act. All the detainees were eventually released without charge. Human rights lawyer Nick Opayo told BuzzFeed News after a meeting with Ugandan ethics minister Simon Lokoto that the outspoken homophobe threatened to mobilize a mob and large police group to beat up anyone who shows up. Organizers said they still hope to hold a pride event sometime later this year.
The government of Tanzania is trying to curb gay sex by banning the import and sale of lubricants. Health Minister Umi Mwalimu said the bizarre ban was justified because the product encourages homosexuality. Tanzania already punishes private, consensual, adult, gay male sex with up to life in prison. Lesbian sex is not even mentioned in the penal code. Human Rights Watch has criticized Tanzania's government for failing to stop rampant abuse against LGBT people or those perceived to be by homophobic thugs and even by the police. Mwalimu claims that taking lubricants off the shelves will help reduce the spread of HIV/AIDS in the Eastern African country, but the global watchdog group says efforts to reduce HIV/AIDS infections are actually being impeded by government-sanctioned abuse of sexual minorities.
Two tragic reports surfaced out of the Middle East this week. A young gay Syrian refugee was raped, stabbed, and beheaded in Istanbul. Friends said they could only identify the mutilated corpse of Muhammad Wissam Sankari by the pants he was wearing. They said he was trying to leave Turkey because he feared for his safety after being repeatedly threatened, kidnapped, and gang-raped. One friend said he ignored their warnings about going out at night. Threats and violence against sexual minorities, or those perceived to be, are common in Turkey's overcrowded refugee camps, and law enforcement protection is virtually non-existent. We can only protect ourselves, the friend said. We stay together to protect ourselves.
Amnesty International has condemned the mid-July execution of a teenage boy in Iran. Hassan Afshar was only 17 in 2014 when he was arrested after another boy's father accused him of forcing his son to have sex with him. Afshar insisted that the sex was consensual and that the supposed victim had willingly engaged in same-gender sex on several previous occasions. If the other boy hadn't called it rape, however, instead of admitting to consensual sex, he too could have faced the death penalty. Now, 19-year-old Afshar was hanged at the prison city of Iraq on July 18th without prior notice to his family after a two-month trial in which he reportedly had no legal representation. While confirmation of such executions in Iran is usually difficult, the charge of raping an underage boy is often used to condemn suspected gay men under the country's strict Islamic law. A photo of two condemned and blindfolded allegedly gay teenage boys next to hangman's nooses shocked the world just a few years ago. According to the global human rights group, Afshar's death marks Iran's first confirmed execution of a juvenile this year. Amnesty says the country executed at least 75 juvenile offenders between 2005 and 2015, including 13 last year. It's hard to believe Iran is a signatory to the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child, which prohibits the use of the death penalty for children.
In other news this week, the U.S. Supreme Court stayed a lower court ruling that had ordered the Gloucester County, Virginia School Board to allow transgender teen Gavin Grimm to use the boys' bathroom. Justices voted 5-3 to put a temporary hold on the court order while they consider a review of the April ruling by the U.S. Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. That court determined that Title IX, the federal law that bans discrimination in public schools based on gender, protects the rights of trans students to use sex-segregated facilities that match their gender identity. The current Gloucester High School policy requires Grimm to use alternative private facilities. So any celebrations of the Fourth Circuit ruling were premature, because he'll still have to use separate facilities when the new school year begins in September. Supreme Court Associate Justice Stephen Breyer tipped the court's 8-judge balance, calling his vote for the stay a courtesy. LGBT Legal Eagles point out that the ruling doesn't forecast the eventual outcome of the case itself or even if the Supreme Court will hear the school board's appeal. That decision won't be made at the earliest until the High Court's new term begins in October.
And finally, a living lesbian legend and a martyred gay icon are each getting well-earned honors. Lily Tomlin will become the first out performer to win the Screen Actors Guild's prestigious Lifetime Achievement Award during the union's annual awards ceremony in January. Tomlin first gained fame as abrasive telephone operator Ernestine and precocious little girl Edith Ann on the fast-paced 1960s TV comedy show Laugh-In. She's never formally come out, But both publicly and privately, Tomlin has always been open about her decades-long professional and personal relationship with her partner, Jane Wagner. The couple married in 2013.
My name is Edith Ann, and that's the truth.
And you may have heard about the recent proposal by the U.S. Secretary of the Navy to add the USNS Harvey Milk to the fleet. Long before he moved from New York to San Francisco, came out, became the first openly gay person to be elected to public office in California, and was assassinated, Harvey Milk served honorably in the Navy during the Korean War. We're not sure if Harvey would have approved of a military Seal of Command Fleet oil ship being named after him, but the honor definitely does not hold water with the Family Research Council. The far-right evangelical Christian group's leader, Tony Perkins, who's credited with writing much of the Republican Party's notoriously homophobic party platform this year, is urging his followers to contact their congressional representatives to strongly oppose naming a Navy ship after the legendary gay activist and politician. Perkins complained that Milk is famous only for winning one election, being murdered, and having sex with men. Insert your own expletive here.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 6, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wendell Jones.
And I'm Jason Proctor.
Queer Life brings out artists in the U.S. movie capital and the Kenyan underground later in the program. A record-breaking 44 out athletes were among the Olympians who strode into Rio's Maracana Stadium for the opening ceremonies on August 5th. Their long road to the Games was paved by the 23 LGBT athletes who competed in 2012 and by the gay man whose incredible performance made headlines 4 years earlier.
Olympic diver Matthew Mitchum comes from behind, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. At the Beijing Games on August 23, 2008, Matthew Mitchum executed a 2.5 somersault with 2.5 twists, earning the highest scoring dive in Olympic history. Grinning from ear to ear, he ran up into the stands to give his partner, Lachlan Fletcher, a kiss after he won. Mitchum came out 3 months before his victory in an interview with the Sydney Morning Herald. In fact, Mitchum was the only openly gay man out of 11,028 athletes at the 2008 Summer Olympics and became the second openly gay Olympic diver to win gold behind Greg Louganis in 1984. Mitchum's win came as a surprise since he had been behind until the last round. With his victory, Australia claimed its first diving gold medal in 84 years. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mike Rutz.
More queer Olympic history was made this year when Brazilian model Leah T became the first trans woman to take part in the lighting of the Olympic torch. Leah T's appearance was touted as representing Brazil's tolerance for diversity, but events may not support that assertion. While Brazil offers legal protections to LGBT people, and Rio hosts what is perhaps the largest pride parade in the world, anti-LGBT violence, especially against trans women, has been escalating. Several lesbian Olympic soccer players have been subjected to homophobic chants during their matches, although no formal complaints have been lodged with FIFA. On the bright side for Team LGBT, New Zealand rower Robbie Manson has won the bronze medal in the men's double sculls.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis, and you're listening to This Way Out.
Grammo suspect dares to speak again, but first...
Hollywood nights, in those Hollywood hills, it was looking so right.
In the heart of Tinseltown, the Hollywood Museum is putting its proud foot forward with an LGBT heritage display entitled Real to Real, Portrayals and Perceptions of Gays in Hollywood. The exhibit is presented in partnership with one of LA's Gay City Council members. One of the first celebrities our Steve Pride ran into at the opening night event.
I'm Mitch O'Farrell, Los Angeles City Council member representing the 13th District here in Los Angeles. We're in Hollywood tonight at the Hollywood Museum with the opening of Reel to Reel, Depictions of Gays and Lesbians in Hollywood. It's the third year running that we do this exhibition with Danelle Dadigan of the Hollywood Museum and her team of curators, and it's an incredible exhibit. And so this is the kickoff opening party.
What are you excited most about this year?
Well, I'm excited about so much. You know, we have the freedom to marry now across the nation from less than 1 year ago now. We are more focused than ever on the rights of our transgendered community. So that's a real hot topic and theme that's nationwide. And so it's important to have events like this to remind us where we've been, because it gives us an indication of where we're going. I have long believed that when the civil rights of any group of individuals or any group of people are diminished, then civil rights for everyone are diminished. We have a lot farther to go. In fact, discrimination is perfectly legal in several states. You could get married in Alabama today and get fired from your job tomorrow because it's legal to do that there and so many other states. So the march, the effort continues, and events like this raise that awareness.
I'm Kat Kramer. Well, I'm here because I always support the museum, and I'm one of the stars of Child of the 70s. I'm also an associate producer on season 3 and 4, and it's been featured in this exhibit. And I know a lot of the, you know, talent and creators, I guess, that are represented. And then my father, Stanley Kramer, we have some Stanley Kramer, a whole Mad World with the dummies of Jonathan Winters and Mickey Rooney, and there's a whole Mad World section here at the museum. I'm also an LGBT activist, an anti-bullying activist. I did a film, Teach Your Children Well, which Lily Tomlin narrated, all about bullying in the schools and LGBT bullying. And well, she's the ambassador to my screening series. We do a lot of social issues together, but that's one that I'm really proud that I presented, because it's not only a leading documentary on the subject, but it's used in schools and churches and to really address the bullying issue.
I'm Reverend Troy Perry, and I'm at this event tonight because I'm one of the three founders of the oldest gay pride parade in the world, and that's here in Los Angeles, California, the Christopher Street West Parade.
A little bit about the importance of gays in the movie. That's what we're here.
Gays in films, that's right. I've always loved different people at different times throughout history. Now, as a gay man, I also love people who were not GLBT, but were wonderful icons of our community. I used to live near Betty Davis over in West Hollywood, and Betty Davis was one of those actresses that I just adored. Another person that I really loved was Burt Lancaster. Burt, for another reason, because he was one of our earliest allies, and our fundraiser against the Briggs Initiative, when they were going to fire every gay school teacher in the state of California at that time, Burt Lancaster emceed our dinner, our first major fundraiser in our community. It was incredible because as a young man, I used to fantasize about him, and to have him introduce me that night as part of the program just made my heart flutter. Sal Mineo was somebody who lived in West Hollywood that I watched him rape Don Johnson every night in Fortune in Men's Eyes, the play. And Don Johnson then was just a teenager. I mean, it was really funny. But I look back and I love this city, and I loved all of those folks who are in television, who are in cinema or on stage, who have made a difference for all of us too.
I'm Erin Murphy, and you probably know me from playing Tabitha on Bewitched. I'm here because I love the Hollywood Museum, and I come to almost everything that Janelle throws here. And I'm here because I'm speaking tonight, because I am a huge supporter of the LGBTQ community, and anytime someone asks me to talk about why, I talk about it.
Is there anything in particular you're looking forward to seeing upstairs?
Kind of everything. It's interesting here because they constantly change the exhibit, so I'm excited to see. I'm a girl, so I like the fashion.
This is Julie Newmar. It's very important, isn't it, for the LGBT community to be celebrated? And I think there's one of my costumes downstairs.
I've been a fan since Little Abner. I did some theater with Peter Palmer. I love that film.
Yes, we were in Little Abner together on Broadway at the St. James Theater. Oh, what a thrill that was. That was so much fun, Little Abner. It even turned into a good movie.
So what is your favorite movie that you've done?
That's a good question. I always think it's the next one, but I'm fooling myself.
Well, who's your favorite Catwoman?
Meow. That's a catty question, and you know it.
Steve Pride attended the opening of the Hollywood Museum's exhibit, Reel to Reel, Portrayals and Perceptions of Gays in Hollywood. For more information, go to thehollywoodmuseum.com.
Young love we share with deep emotion.
Hello, I'm Tab Hunter, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all of our sexually diverse communities.
Kenyan rap and spoken word artist Gramo Suspect continues to stick her neck out for equality with her latest single, Hashtag Injustice. It tells the story of three LGBT people who have faced discrimination in her country and features the reggae beat by producer Herbalist of Herbal Records.
Living in this world, love's candle. We need to come up, rise up and fight for our rights and power. Hello, our rights and power. Hello, the innocent are crying. Their cry is silent. Rise up and fight for our rights and power. Hello, our rights and power.
From class one, always number one in every assignment. Went to Sunday school, at 10 she was taking the sacrament. Did everything. The parents asked of her with no argument. Clever, observant, God-fearing, the constitution that needed no amendment. At 18, in many young men's heart, she was the monument. Using the word beautiful to describe her is an understatement. So, they flocked her house, others begging to pay dowry payment. But the only thing in her mind was what she was waiting for. University enrollment. Then one day in college canteen when she was taking refreshment is when she met what we would call her today's predicament. She now lives in poverty due to lack of employment. They denied her degree because they found out about her engagement. Falling in love with a fellow woman caused this punishment. Something that is beyond her understanding, stronger than any government. The more she prayed about it, the stronger was the attachment, and the injustice left her in nothing, nothing short of resentment.
Living in this world of scandal, we need to come up, rise up and fight for our rights and power. Oh, our rights and power. Oh, the innocent.
Always viewed as different from tender age through his puberty in each and every element. He chose to be addressed as corny in netball tournaments, felt more comfortable in a dress, yes, the female garment, and often hence lived with an uncle who worked in law enforcement, the same person who for a decade used him for his fulfillment. Verbal, physical and sexual abuse were the uncle's source of entertainment, where at times called upon his elder son for reinforcement. For a very long, long time, this young boy lived in torment. He prayed long and hard for God to send him to retirement. But instead, three types of infections were the doctor's establishment. And due to this cause, the poor boy was denied treatment. His uncle was the law, hence, there was no written statement. There was no way he could prove his involvement. Trans injustice led to this boy's discrimination, harassment, and then imprisonment. Mr. President, there's no doubt that these laws need reassessment.
Living in this world of scandal, we need to come up, rise up and fight for our rights and power. Oh, for our rights and power. Oh, the innocent are crying, they are crying in silence. Rise up and fight for our rights and power. Oh, for our rights and power.
The word his father used to describe his son's love was embarrassment. At his 10th birthday celebration, which was followed by the denouncement. A few minutes before, Dan's father had made a surprise announcement. Son, go and kiss the love of your life, was the statement. Courageously, Dan stood up and headed straight to where Peter was to everyone's astonishment, smiled at him and smiled back, then they kissed to everyone's amazement. That simple act of love brought about a serious change of environment. Things turned dramatic and sour, quite the opposite of intended enjoyment. Just like that, the innocent boy was forced to face displacement after his angry father fiercely and publicly declared disownment. This is oppression of the highest level to mankind without measurement. We need to fight these vices that are nothing short of enslavement. Freedom is never free. We all need to have this acknowledgement. It's time to fight for this human's right without any postponement. In the Constitution, protection of the minority groups was the argument. Hence, we have every right to ask the government for endorsement.
Living in this world of scandal, we need to come up, rise up and fight for our rights and power. Oh, for our rights and power. Oh, the innocent are crying, they are crying.
You can find Grammo Suspect's hashtag injustice video on YouTube. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, Jason Proctor, Mike Rutz with Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and Steve Pride contributed program material. John Williams, Bob Seger, The Cat Burglars, and Grammo Suspect performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations like WERU in Bangor and Blue Hill Falls, Maine, and you, our listener supporters, especially John Beaupre's gift in memory of Christopher David Trentum, all of whom are making this show possible. This week's News Wrap segment was sponsored by David Hunt in loving memory of David Fratkin. Check out the latest This Way Out program information and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email twroradio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KRCL Salt Lake City, Utah, 3OCR Colac, Victoria, WCBN Ann Arbor, Michigan, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
To Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sata Lilly. Did the 20th century have to be the century of U.S. empire? That's a question posed by three-time Academy Award-winning filmmaker Oliver Stone in a remarkable DVD collection. Known for such films as Born on the 4th of July and Wall Street, Stone has created a gripping antidote to the myths of American power. The 12-part documentary series is called The Untold History of the United States. Stone co-wrote, directed, produced, and narrated it. Historian Peter Kuznick co-wrote the series along with a companion book of the same name. Kuznick teaches at the American University and writes about science, politics, nuclear weapons, and the Cold War. Today we're going to present some excerpts from the 12-hour documentary series, a series which journalist Glenn Greenwald has said he cannot recommend highly enough. The Untold History is available as a 4-DVD box set, which you can get along with an almost 800-page book for your pledge of $240 to this radio station by calling 1-800-439-5732 or pledging online at kpfa.org. Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick spoke at Left Forum in New York City on a panel moderated by Bill Fletcher. Today we'll play highlights from their discussion, but we'll begin with a clip from the start of the film, The Untold History of the United States.
Hello, I'm Oliver Stone. When I was a young boy growing up in New York City, I thought I received a good education. I studied history extensively, especially American history. It made sense. We were the center of the world. There was a manifest destiny. We were the good guys. Well, I've traveled the world now. I continued my education as an infantryman in Vietnam. Made a lot of movies, some of them about history. And I've learned a lot more than I once knew. And when I heard from my children what they were learning at school, I was perturbed to hear that they were not really getting a more honest view of the world than I did. We lived much of our lives in a fog, all of us. But I would like
like my children have access to something that looks beyond what I call the tyranny of now. Watch the media, everyone talks about that thing, the news of the day, and all the subconscious, really important stuff that's going on is being neglected. Napoleon once said that history is a pack of lies agreed upon. Well, I'm not sure I agree. I believe history does have a meaning, does have a purpose, and there is a pattern to be found. And I wanted, with my colleagues, rather than make another feature film, to tell the American story in a way that has never been told before. There are many questions that you may not find answered here, but you will find questions raised that I hope will help make you more conscious. We are going to propose, among other things, a forgotten set of heroes. People who suffered for their beliefs and who have been lost to history because they did not conform. And we are going to debunk some of those heroes that you believe in, not with malice, but by restating the facts. Unless we remind ourselves of the good that we have lost, it's not easy to imagine a better future. By showing you the patterns of behavior which have come to be and you perhaps have not noticed before, trying to bring you back to the mean of this country and what so radically changed after World War II. There have been some profound mistakes, but we still have a chance, I strongly believe, to correct them.
Good evening. Oliver, Peter, good evening. When I saw this documentary, I was sitting at home with my wife and my mouth dropped and I said, Candace, this is like on mainstream television, am I missing something? And what inspired this? I mean, where did this documentary come from?
You know, I grew up conservative and I grew up Republican. My father was on Wall Street and I went to Vietnam, I believed they were fighting communists. So I'm probably a little bit different from most of you. And Peter was protesting the nuclear bomb way back in the 50s probably, and then he was protesting the Vietnam War. So I reached a place in my life, to make a long story short, Greg Wilpert just summed it up very nicely, but when I did Salvador, when I went to Central America with Boyle in the 1980s, let's say I became progressively enlightened after my experience in Vietnam, but I was seeing Vietnam redux. I was seeing the same behavior, the desire to repress the poor, the reform candidates, the labor, teachers, nuns. It was Reagan's policy supporting the dictators there and the death squads that started to happen in Salvador and Honduras. And the Contra and Guatemala, of course, and the Contra war against Nicaragua. It was Vietnam redux, and I saw the whole thing, and I said, "Wow, I got to do something more in my life than make movies like Midnight Express and Scarface." So basically, I took another tack, and I did Salvador, which made very little money and very little, but it made some impact. And I found out that America's interest in Latin America is very minimal. Americans don't go to movies about it. That's just a fact, documentary or fiction. But I made it anyway, and I'm very happy with the result. Very proud of that film. But then I... Thank you. We can talk more about Latin America later in your questions. But I kept trying to make progressive films, and I got more and more with Vietnam, Wall Street, JFK, Nixon. I got more and more research done in my life. I met more and more people, and obviously you evolve. So my life is really about evolution. And I reached this place when George Bush was in office for that second four-year term, when I was just had enough. It was up to here. I said, I can't go on making only movies because I know too much now. I've seen too much in my lifetime. I grew up under the atomic bomb, the shadow of it, which is where I wanted to start this thing. So I wanted to go back with the remainder of the time and energy that I had left and really do a documentary because I've been accused endlessly of distorting the truth in my dramatic histories. So I wanted to go back and do it documentary style, with fact checks, which we did three of, and put it all down in from 1900 to now. We actually have 12 hours, which was going to come out on DVD in October. This is a story of the mask coming off. And this is the way I see it. And Peter sees it because Peter and I had been friends since 1996. And he told me, I was very fascinated by the atomic bomb, the real story, because I'd always accepted the cop-out that the United States had to drop the bomb, that World War II ended triumphantly because we dropped the bomb, etc. So Peter told me this incredible story about not just the bomb, but the origins of that Henry Wallace story that seeds back to 1944. And you have to think about the possibilities if Wallace had been elected.
And when in 1996, over dinner, after Oliver came to my class, I laid out this vision. I said, Oliver, this is an idea for a movie that you've got to make at some point. And I talked about how close Henry Wallace came to being back on the ticket as vice president, and what would have happened if Wallace, who was the most radical man ever to get close to the presidency, had become president in 1945 when Roosevelt died instead of Truman. That opened up all kinds of new vistas. And we weren't able to make the feature film back then, but we kept on talking about this over the years. We stayed friends. And then in 2007, we're having dinner in D.C., and Oliver says, let's do it. Let's do a documentary. And at that point, we thought, at least for a few minutes, we were going to do one 60- or 90-minute documentary about Henry Wallace and the atomic bombing and the origins of the Cold War. By the time I went to see Oliver 2 weeks later in New York to map it out, Oliver said, no, let's do a 10-part, 10-hour documentary film series. So I was on sabbatical. I thought this was going to take maybe a year and then it would be over. We worked on this almost nonstop for 5 years. And we ended up doing 12 episodes. When we released the box set in October, and Warner Brothers is going to do it at the least as inexpensively as possible, so we want a mass audience for this, we're going to show all 12 episodes in the box set, which includes our work that takes back to the late 19th century and goes through the origins of World War II, because that period is very, very important also. But most of this is going to start, as you see here, with World War II and with the atomic bomb. And the first episode is really about World War II.
The Sangre de Cristo, or Blood of Christ, mountain range is one of the United States' most remote and primitive landscapes. In an isolated ranch house, the world's top scientists, many of them European, gather nervously in the chill morning air. Nearby, in the darkness, something hangs atop a steel tower, a bomb. Today, they will test it. The test is codenamed Trinity. The inspiration, John Donne, Robert Oppenheimer's favorite poet. One of the premier scientists of his age, Oppenheimer loved literature in the desert of the Southwest. He was a peaceful man who just happened to have created and coordinated the most destructive weapon in all history. Only a few miles away, the project's military commander, Brigadier General Leslie Groves, is the man responsible for building the War Department's gigantic new headquarters in Virginia, known as the Pentagon. He doesn't like relying on unreliable civilian scientists. His career is on the line.
Here it is, General Groves, plutonium.
That's the first time I've seen it. If you don't mind, I wish you'd hold that under it, because after all, there's about $50 million in that test.
The automatic controls got it now. Robert, this time the stakes are really high.
It's going to work all right, Robert, and I'm sure we'll never be sorry for it.
In 40 seconds, we'll know.
In the last few minutes, general silence is observed as a countdown begins. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. In 5:29 and 45 seconds, the bomb detonates. The light is brighter than the sun. During the explosion, Oppenheimer recalls a line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita.
Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds.
This terrifying weapon would launch the United States on a journey turning the refuge of the Founding Fathers into a militarized state.
An excerpt from the 12-part, 12-hour documentary series, The Untold History of the United States, directed and co-produced by Oliver Stone. That's his voice narrating the film. You're listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Just coming to you right now to encourage you to support KPFA on this last day that Against the Grain is asking you for your hard-earned money. I want to let you know that you can get the 4-DVD set. As I say, it's 12 hours, 12 documentary series, 12-part documentary series for less than $30 a month over 6 months. That's a pledge of $175. Or if you would like to get it in combination with the book that Oliver Stone and his collaborator in this project, Peter Kuznick, penned together, it's almost 800 pages long, you can get that for $240 by calling 1-800-439-5732. There's a reason why this documentary series has been so popular here on KPFA as a thank you gift, because I think listeners have really responded to the breadth of material and the depth that Stone and Kuznick achieved here, even though they were having to produce these and of course edit them for the confines of television. So that was within an hour, looking in depth at key moments, and the way they approached their work here was to say, what are the pivotal moments in U.S. history where things could have gone in a different way? It's powerful. They look at the Russian Revolution, World War II, as you can hear from the clip we just heard, the dropping of the U.S. Atomic bomb, the creation of the bomb and the dropping of the bomb, the Cold War, the Bay of Pigs, and it goes all the way to the present, to Barack Obama's wars. It is a wonderful thank you gift. I'm going to play more from the film and also from the discussion that the filmmakers had, but I want to give you the opportunity to call right now. 1-800-439-5732. That's easy to remember as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And, of course, you can always pledge securely online at kpfa.org. The next excerpt that we're going to listen to looks at U.S. foreign policy, and you will recognize the voices of John F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr. It's then followed by a discussion between Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick with Bill Fletcher moderating.
Let us never fear to negotiate.
These Germans escaped by the tens of thousands until the communists threw up their wall of hate. The assault has begun on the dictatorship of Fidel Castro.
This generation of Americans has already had enough, more than enough, of war and hate and oppression.
I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men. I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. But they ask, and rightly so, what about Vietnam? If America's soul becomes totally poisoned, part of the autopsy must read Vietnam, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift, is approaching spiritual death. This need to maintain social stability for our investments accounts for the counter-revolutionary action of American forces in Guatemala. It tells why American helicopters are being used against guerrillas in Cambodia, and why American napalm and Green Beret forces have already been active against rebels in Peru. They ask if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. My questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghetto without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
I want to actually go back prior to the events that are covered here on this particular clip, because the scariest episode for me was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And one of the things that you convey is that there have been several moments when we've been on the verge of nuclear war. And I can remember as a kid the fear that I felt at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and I was very young, but the fear was everywhere. And I would appreciate it if you could take us through what exactly happened. What is it that most people do not understand about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Can you do it quickly, Peter?
The Cuban Missile Crisis, where people have a sense how close we came to actual war, but they don't really know the details of it, which we've been finding out lately from some of the documents that have been released. And the scariest moment, which Schlesinger said was not only the scariest moment of this crisis, but the scariest moment in all human history, was when U.S. ships were dropping depth charges on a Soviet submarine that was approaching the blockade line, and the power went out in the Soviet submarine. The carbon dioxide was rising. The sailors were fainting. The officers were fainting, passing out. The chief officer says, the war must have started already. We're down here doing somersaults. We should launch our nuclear torpedo. The Americans had no idea that they had nuclear weapons on this submarine that we were knocking out down there. So they gave the order to launch. Fortunately, the sub-commander said, talked him out of launching. Had he not talked him out of launching, then, and his name was Arkhipov, this man named Arkhipov, who was unknown to history, single-handedly prevented nuclear war from starting that day. Had they launched, the United States would have retaliated with nuclear weapons, and much of the world as we know it probably wouldn't be here now. So that was about the scariest moment, but that was not known to the public. Even what was known to the public, the pressure on Kennedy to invade Cuba was enormous. The entirety of his Joint Chiefs of Staff were pushing him to do it. All of his advisors were pushing him to do it. Even people like Sorensen and Robert at one point were encouraging a U.S. surgical strike followed by an invasion. Had we done that, we were completely ignorant of what was going on there. We didn't know that the weapons were there, that they were installed, that they were ready to launch. We didn't know where they were. We didn't know how many there were. And what we really didn't know was that there were battlefield nuclear weapons, 100 battlefield nuclear weapons also. Initially, McNamara said we would lose maybe 1,800 people. Then when he found out some more of the details, that there were three times as many armed Cubans and four times as many armed Russian Soviet soldiers there, then he said we would have lost 25,000 people in an invasion. When he found out that they had 100 battlefield nuclear weapons, McNamara almost passed out 30 years later. And he says, if we had invaded, we would have lost 100,000 men. We would have wiped out Cuba and very likely the Soviet Union also. And so that's how close we came. We were acting out of ignorance, as we often do in these situations. And what Kennedy and Khrushchev both learned from this is that these kind of crises cannot be controlled. There was that, even though both of them were doing everything they could to avoid confrontation and war there, they both concluded that there was no way to control a crisis like this. So Khrushchev contacts Kennedy and says, we have to eliminate every possible conflict that can lead to another confrontation like this. And Kennedy and Khrushchev, from late 1962, through Kennedy's assassination, did everything they could both to roll back on all of these crises and to end the Cold War. So our interpretation of Kennedy in the last year is very different than the Kennedy who in the 1950s as a senator and the Kennedy the first 2 years of his administration when he remained a Cold War hawk. But Kennedy learned something that most American presidents, and like Barack Obama, have not learned. How dangerous this situation is and the folly of this kind of confrontation when you've got people armed to the teeth in this kind of world.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly. Let's return now to excerpts from the discussion between Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick, and Bill Fletcher, talking about whether Henry Wallace, had he remained vice president under Franklin Delano Roosevelt and continued in that position after FDR died, would have been the most progressive president in U.S. history.
It's amazing how quick it goes. If Roosevelt had lived 3 more months, the whole world would be a different shape. If Wallace had become president in April 45, the whole world would be different. It's amazing how the curve of the ball breaks sometimes. But that was pure bad luck the way he died.
Okay, I want to pursue this point that you're just making, Oliver, because at different points you do highlight the role of certain individuals, Roosevelt, Wallace, etc. But my question is, are you putting too much on these individuals? I mean, in other words, I think that the record is fairly clear in terms of Wallace, what Wallace, Henry Wallace stood for. But there are other factors that are at play when these individuals get into office. And had Wallace been elected president or taken over as vice president or been elected in 48, why should we believe that things would have fundamentally changed? I mean, what I wondered in watching this is, this is one vicious country. This is a vicious country. And we know that in the 1930s, there was a plot to overthrow Roosevelt, trying to enlist Smedley Butler and veterans. It seems to me that in the middle of the Cold War, something very similar could have happened. So, but in any case, I mean, what is it that leads you to believe that these individuals would ultimately have made that much of a difference in terms of where we ended up?
Well, there's no way to know. You know, we can't say for sure what would have happened had Wallace become president instead of Truman. As we show, Wallace came extraordinarily close to getting to be back on the ticket as vice president in 1944. In fact, he was the second most popular man in America. Even though he called for the century of the common man, he called for worldwide people's revolution, he denounced America's fascists, who he said were those Wall Street interests who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second. Now we call them Democrats and Republicans. He had a very radical vision. But he was enormously popular because the country was more progressive then. We were fighting a war against fascism and German and Japanese militarism. Gallup released a poll on July 20th, 1944, the start of the Democratic Convention, that asked potential voters who they wanted on the ticket as vice president. 65% said they wanted Henry Wallace as vice president. 2% said they wanted Harry Truman. But the convention was stacked. But Wallace gave the seconding speech for Roosevelt that opening night. The place went wild, even though the party bosses thought they had it controlled. 45-minute demonstration led by people like Hubert Humphrey and Adlai Stevenson. And in the middle of that, Claude Pepper, the senator from Florida, nicknamed Red Pepper because of his politics, he makes his way up to the microphone, knowing if he could get Wallace's name and nomination that night, he'll sweep the convention and be back on the ticket as vice president. Pepper got literally 5 feet from the microphone when the bosses managed to adjourn the convention that night. And so that's how close we came. Had Wallace gotten in there, he could have stopped the atomic bombing. He could have done that on his own authority, and we know that he would have done that, or we know as much as we can know anything. Could he have stopped the Cold War? That's a different question. As you're saying, there are structural forces in place. But 1945 was not like today. 1945, we were a much more progressive country. 1945, the Soviets were our allies. They were lionized for having just won World War II. They were the ones the reason why the British weren't speaking German was because of the Soviet Union. And people understood that at that point. So I think he could have certainly resisted the kind of Cold War we had and very likely changed it.
That's the voice of historian Peter Kuznick speaking at Left Forum with his collaborator in a 12-part documentary series, Oliver Stone. The conversation was moderated by activist Bill Fletcher, Jr., and you are listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Jumping in again here to let you know that you can pledge your support to this vital media outlet and get the 12-part, 12-hour box set on 4 DVDs of The Untold History of the United States by Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone for a bit less than $30 a month over the course of 6 months by calling 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also pledge online, as at least one listener has done so recently, to pledge for The Untold History of the United States, kpfa.org. If you are interested, you can get get a combination of the 12-hour DVD set, along with the companion book that Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone have written, that isn't just sort of a bedside read that you can, you know, open up as you're watching the film, but actually is a work of serious history in its own right, full of footnotes and packed with critical information about the rise of the American Empire in the late 19th century, the emergence of the national security state, and these crucial moments where history could have gone more than one way. And, well, I mean, of course, that's all of history, but moments where it would have made a disproportionate impact. And so much of history is presented to us as something that was a fait accompli, that it had to unfold the way it did. And actually, that's nonsense. It's a very disempowering notion about how the world changes. And what they do is to point out how, in these crucial moments, the actions of people made an enormous difference, whether it was the Cuban Missile Crisis. They argue that Henry Wallace would have been the most progressive president the U.S. has ever seen had he managed to stay the vice president, had he not died, that these crucial things are the essence of a radical understanding of history, that things are flexible, that they can change, that they change because people make them change. And KPFA is a absolute example of that. We are here because people support us. And from Fund Drive, we don't know if we will have that support. We just don't know. And if you support the work that we do, if you care about the work that we do, this is the time to stand up and show it by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. I'd like to play a little bit more of this documentary so that you can get a fuller sense of what's in here. But let me give the number one more time, 1-800-439-5732. Let's take a listen to another clip from the documentary series, The Untold History of the United States, which looks at war making under Obama.
Instead of fighting for transparency, however, Obama became a far more effective manager of the national security state. Like Bush, he repeatedly invoked the state secrets privilege in lawsuits involving torture, extraordinary rendition, and illegal NSA eavesdropping. He blocked habeas corpus rights for enemy combatants, preserved military commissions, and authorized without due process the killing of a U.S. citizen in Yemen, accused of having ties to Al-Qaeda. Obama stunned civil libertarians when he took Bush-era investigations to the next level and began prosecuting government whistleblowers and reporters using the World War I-era Espionage Act. Only three cases had been brought in 92 years. Obama initiated six cases of dubious merit, most defendants claiming to have exposed unlawful activity in the government. Most prominent was Bradley Manning, an Army intelligence analyst in Iraq, who leaked over 260,000 classified diplomatic cables and war reports, as well as videos, distributed by WikiLeaks, a non-profit whistleblower media organization. These revelations of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan and U.S. support for dictatorial regimes in the region proved to be a significant catalyst for the Arab Spring uprisings in Egypt, Tunisia, Yemen, Libya, and Bahrain. Nonetheless, Obama's administration has severely impaired the operation of WikiLeaks and threatens to prosecute its co-founder. These actions send a clear message to all whistleblowers. Commit war crimes like Bush and Cheney and you walk free. Expose them and you risk careers and huge fines. Or, like Manning, you rot in jail.
Empires, we don't make these sacrifices for territory or for resources. We do it because it's right. Never forget that you are part of an unbroken line of heroes spanning two centuries. to your grandparents and parents who faced down fascism and communism, and deliver justice to those who attacked us on 9/11.
Thus sanctioning, once again, Bush's lie about the connection of 9/11 to Iraq. The words were barely out of his mouth before Iraq was racked with a new series of deadly suicide bombings.
You know, politics don't make good bedfellows with Hollywood. They're very hard to make political movies. Most of the political movies have been to the right, frankly. The Rambo series is very successful, as was the Chuck Norris Missing in Action. A lot of the Zero Dark Thirty is, again, very supportive of our policy and of vigilantism. And, I mean, even Argo gives a very, a thrilling movie, gives a very pro-American point of view about Iran and doesn't really tell us the background. So, you know, that's what you're facing. There are some occasionally, I think, progressive movies that get through, like Syriana, I thought was interesting and very different, but it wasn't a big moneymaker. So it's very hard to get this made. All these movies. I could not probably make JFK today or Nixon. Not even close. I got Bush was financed. The W movie was financed. 55% of that money came from Hong Kong. So nobody was interested in this country. We're not... Hollywood dissuades you from doing it. The most liberal section, the liberal era in Hollywood filmmaking was the 1930s and early 40s, when all these communists were working. And the guy who wrote Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Sidney Buckman, was a communist member of the party, and a lot of them were blacklisted and graylisted, and you know the story. So the most liberal period is gone, and I think the 80s were a disaster. Platoon was sort of a, and Born on the Fourth were, started to go the other way. But by the 1990s, when Bush Sr. got in office, we had the whole rap about the greatest generation, World War II generation, neglecting, of course, the fact that, a lot of that generation had been pro-Nazi and fascist, did not want involvement in Spain, were willing, our businesses, our corporations, were doing business with Nazi Germany up to 1941, some beyond. Profits from many of those companies, Ford, GM, were repatriated after the war. There was a, we always had a very strong German, America has always had a strong fascist leaning. And it came back in. We took all the German scientists we could, and we took all the spy agency. We took this monster Gehlen, who into our embrace, Angleton and Dulles and all those scumbags, brought them in, and basically, you know, started an anti-Soviet, the old anti-Soviet propaganda machine recycled right after World War II, right away. So the films have not reflected that, frankly, and will never. I don't know. I don't know how to get around it. Money means you have to make people happy, and you have to have a good... The problem with history, in American history, and I'm going to quickly get to a point, is that the kids don't like it, and they don't really care about it because it's so sanitized like a Disney movie. They take all the horror, juicy horror stuff out of history in school, and you don't get this kind of history, and the kids get bored because they know it's bull. American triumphalism... And it's American triumphalism in the movies, it's in the history books, it's all around us, it permeates our culture, it permeates the evening news. It's sad. It's sad that we're living in this warped vision of the world. It's a bubble. But I can't do much business there if I talk like that and do like that. But I have to get my, I get my message out this way. This movie was not really been seen. It's a premium cable. Some people really like it, and I have to say some very... Big people, wonderful people, really appreciate it, but it's not really known yet, and I hope we'll get more and more adherence to it, because we're out to make, we're out, Peter and I are out to make this a 10, 20-year journey, hopefully to get it into schools. We're trying in California.
And that is Oliver Stone speaking with his co-writer, historian Peter Kuznick at Left Forum about the 12-part, 12 documentary series, the set that they produced about U.S. empire in the 20th and 21st centuries. My name is Sasha Lilly, alongside C.S. Song. We are here for to raise money for Against the Grain, for KPFA, and very pleased to be able to offer up to you a compelling documentary series that has been really well received by our listeners, and we hope you will join them and subscribe right now. Sign up to be a supporter of KPFA. The documentary series looks at the history of empire and does so in a way that few productions of its caliber are able. It's beautifully scored and edited. It's rigorously fact-checked. It was fact-checked, in fact, three different times. And what is at the heart of the project, of the series, is a task to dismantle the myths of the right and strip away the triumphalism that characterizes most discussions of U.S. power in the mainstream media. Now, if that seems like something we've been hearing a great deal of recently, then this may be the thank you gift for you. And, of course, what you get is KPFA. And I guess I would say that those of us who live in the center of this empire, I think we have an obligation of sorts to do something to oppose it. And one of the ways you can oppose it is by supporting KPFA, which was founded by pacifists in the depths of the Cold War. And your donation is tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. And it diverts a portion of your taxes from the military to an institution that's premised on opposing empire. So if that sounds really good to you, then please support us right now. 1-800-439-5732 is the number to call. Easy to remember as 1-800-HEY-KPFA. For less than $30 a month over 6 months, you can get the 4-DVD, 12-part, 12-hour documentary series, The Untold History of the United States. If you'd like to get it along with the companion book, which is 800 pages full of really sort of rounding out this full picture of U.S. empire, the rise of the national security state, you can do so for a $240 pledge. But the key thing is that you do it, and that you do it right now. 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA, and you can go, of course, to kpfa.org. And I just want to remind you that when we, during fund drives, when KPFA comes to you and offers you as a thank you gift a single DVD, very frequently the typical price is a $100 pledge of support per DVD. So if you were to pledge separately for each DVD in the series, it would require a $1,200 pledge. But if you pledge right now for this series and the nearly 800-page companion book, you can do so for a mere $240. If that sounds good to you, then we'd love to hear from you right now. 1-800-439-5732. Our phone volunteers are standing by waiting for you to pick up your phone. You can also do it, of course, online at kpfa.org.
And we also have this fabulous combo pack, this $1 a day to KPFA over a year combo pack of $365 for not just this 4-DVD, 12-part, 12-hour series, Untold History of the United States, but also the Capitalism series, and that is a 6-part, 5-hour documentary film series you may have heard portions of in other slots on KPFA this fund drive, in which thinkers like Noam Chomsky and David Graeber and Thomas Piketty examine and critique the ideas of Adam Smith, Karl Marx, John Maynard Keynes, and many others. Give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. The Untold History of the United States, as Sasha was saying, is a wonderful deal, quote, deal, in terms of how much you get for your pledge of $175. But also consider really getting a discounted, fantastic combo pack if you have the money. And if you want to put up, especially, for example, if you want to put up a match or a challenge for the rest of this fund drive, get the Untold History 4-DVD set and the Capitalism, the 6-part, 5-hour documentary film series, all for a $1 a day pledge to KPFA over a year, although we'll ask you to put it on installments if you can't pay it all in once, and we prefer 6 months worth of installments at this point. 1-800-439-5732. This is the last day, this fund drive that Against the Grain, that Sasha and I are coming to you. This is a kind of referendum on the work that we do. If you like this program, if you want this program to continue, if you want it to survive, if you want to make a point to the powers that be here that this program is appreciated, it's desired, it's relied upon, people care about it, you're getting information here that's in-depth, that's thoughtful, that's rigorous. We disagree with there is a trend in some of left media of a kind of anti-intellectualism, that people don't take ideas seriously. If you think that the kind of a treatment we give to topics, the kind of obsessive, thorough treatment we give to topics is appreciated and wanted and needed in this media environment. Give us a call right now, 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can keep waiting, but then the time's going to be over, and especially we've only got 12 minutes left to ask you to support specifically Against the Grain this drive.
1-800-439-5732 is the number to call us right now. We'd love to hear from you. And you will get, of course, more than anything, you will get the future of KPFA, or at least through the next couple months. And I'd say that means a lot. We are indeed living through tumultuous times. The history that this series lays out really does help understand the present in so many ways. It's sort of the arc that has led us up to this point. It's really information I think all of us need. And I think we need KPFA during a time like this. And I would even hazard that Against the Grain would be an important tool to have during such times as well. If you agree with that, please call and pledge right now, 1-800-439-5732. Pledge what you can afford. If you can afford to get the 12-part series on DVD for a $240 pledge, that would be wonderful. If you can do the dollar a day to KPFA for the DVD set along with a capitalism DVD set, which we have been playing often during this fund drive, that would be a wonderful way to support us. The crucial thing, though, is that you do it. And this documentary series, The Untold History of the United States, covers so much ground in a way that is accessible and powerful and well put together and doesn't bend the facts. Some of the material in the series includes World War I, the Russian Revolution, the Battle of Ideas, Roosevelt, Hitler, Stalin, about the enormous sacrifice by the Soviet Union during World War II. It talks about Roosevelt, Truman, and Henry Wallace. Would Wallace have been the most progressive president in U.S. history had he remained vice president when FDR died? The rise of the Third World, the Cold War, the whole Cuban Missile Crisis, something so many people who did not live through that time have no handle on, how close the world came, or parts of the world, to annihilation during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Vietnam War, the rise of the right in the U.S., a key feature of our times, the end of the Cold War, the squandered peace, the Bush and Clinton years, the wars of those years, the post-September 11th America, the age of terror, and Barack Obama's wars. All of this is history that all of us need to know, and many of us don't. And this is a wonderful way to inform yourself. Just a fantastic series, so watchable, so well put together, so accessible. It would make a fantastic gift. You know, if you think about gifts, you could think about the gift of pledging to KPFA. You give to us. Hopefully we're giving back to you as well. You're giving to your community. You're keeping KPFA going. You're keeping it going for that person who hasn't discovered KPFA yet, but one day perhaps in their car will be moving their radio dial and arrive and think, what is this? What is this thing that I've just discovered? And then to take this gift thread a little further, you could take the box set and give it as a gift to someone that you care about. It's a wonderful, it would certainly make a wonderful present. And then you get to take a big chunk of it off your taxes as well. 1-800-439-5732. It's 1-800-HEY-KPFA, kpfa.org. And we are, as CS said, this is the last day that the two of us will come to you, that Against the Grain will come to you during this fund drive, asking for your support. We're asking for your support for this station, most definitely. But we're also asking for your support for what we do here on Against the Grain. And we hope that you feel like what we do here really matters and you want to support that. So I'm encouraging all of you to register that support right now. And there's still incentive, which is that two fine listeners from Oakland, Mel and John, have together put up a challenge to us of $480, which that means that they will double your donation up to $480. You don't have to pledge $480, but Pledge what you can and they will match it. So it's a conditional pledge. We have 7 minutes, a little less than 7 minutes to go to the top of the hour. It means that, in effect, when you pledge, your money goes further. It is a wonderful way to maximize your support, if I can put it that way. And we'd love for you to call us right now. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. So many fantastic thank you gifts on offer. The Capitalism series is just fantastic. This documentary series that we've been playing highlights from is also, as I say, revelatory, accessible, really well produced. Think about getting them together for a pledge of $365, a dollar a day to KPFA, 1-800-439-5732. And in this matching period, your dollars are doubled.
Martin Sherwin, author of American Prometheus, says, Kuznick and Stone's untold history is the most important historical narrative of this century. Daniel Ellsberg says, Howard Zinn would have loved this people's history of the American empire. This is a thought-provoking rebuttal to the nationalist myths that are far too often served up as history. The range of information is amazing. I will tell you that not too long ago, and I'm not going to confess the exact time, I didn't really know that much about recent U.S. history. And this is absolutely essential to know what happened, what really happened, what happened that we don't hear about that isn't reported in the mainstream media, to really get a grasp on, to understand our current situation, understand where we come from, and understand where we might go in the future. This is amazing stuff. It's such a high-value thank you gift, $175, not one DVD, but not one part or six parts or 10 hours. This is 12 hours to really think about and to mull over and to understand and to discuss with friends and to inform your understanding and to inform how you approach all the surface noise today, all the political news. There's just an avalanche of political details that we get in our news. How do we make sense of it? How do we understand it? Well, we understand it when we put it into context, when we understand what this nation has done, what this nation has done to people within its nation, beyond its borders. 1-800-439-5732. This kind of information, I would agree with so many people, so many pundits and ordinary folks who've come forward and said the untold history of the United States is absolutely indispensable to have. And it's also a video. You don't have to pour through it. You don't have to read, you know, page after page of small type. No, you just put it in your computer or your DVD player and you watch it and you absorb it. 1-800-439-5732. Every dollar you give is doubled. Do you want to vote at this point for this program, for the work that Sasha does, which is really unlike anyone else in the media? The way she attacks her subjects, the way she gets really thought-provoking people who know a ton about their material. She reads books. This woman reads books and then gets people on to talk about them. If you want to honor that, because there are so many people who just, oh, you know, so what's the book about? Oh, okay, and that's about all I have to ask. 1-800-439-5732. Your dollars get doubled. People here know then if you call within the next 3.5 minutes, plenty of time to make that call, that Against the Grain deserves to be here, is valued, and people care about it. 1-800-HEY-KPFA.
1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. One of the things that motivated the series was, as I mentioned earlier, a focus on kind of pivotal moments in history. And I think we're living through one of them now, and I'm not talking about the elections, that there are these sort of crucial moments where history can go in different directions because people push them in different directions. And I think it's at those moments where actually knowing prior history is most important, to root the actions of today in some knowledge about how things have unfolded in the past. So I strongly encourage you to think about getting this 12-part series, The Untold History of the United States, to have to give yourselves, give all of us a foothold. And we have just over 2 minutes left. We have a match on the line. And it is really crucial that we get your support right now, that we can make this match and bring in the money that Against the Grain needs to bring in and KPFA needs to stay on the air. If you think this is a vital institution, if you think that when you think about empire, when you think about the national security state, when you think about all of the upheavals, social movements, if you think about the necessity of KPFA when you picture its absence, if I am putting that in a way that's understandable, think about not having a KPFA in a time like this. Think about how that would be for you. And if that is something that leaves you knowing that you would be bereft, then please support us right now by picking up your phone and calling 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-HEY-KPFA. Your dollars are doubled right now thanks to these two very kind listeners. We appreciate their generosity. We appreciate your generosity. KPFA is this remarkable collective project. It couldn't be around if people just out of the goodness of their hearts and their sense that to contribute helps them and helps their larger community. That's the only way this entity, this institution survives. And it's remarkable that it's worked, but it happens fund drive. So we need you to come through for us right now. We've got just over half a minute left. $480 is on the line. Wonderful thank you gifts on offer. But, of course, the crucial thing, the most important thing of all, is that you keep getting KPFA, that you keep this this beacon alive that was created by pacifists right up against empire. People who had actually been interned for their being conscientious objectors during World War II, people who had opposed war in a very visceral way, they founded this network. Pacifica is called Pacifica for a reason, and if that is something that you think needs to continue, needs to stick around, then do your part right now. 1-800-439-5732.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.